rear tile flanges of cone cone. And I said, with me, it's when it takes custody of me. It grabs me.
I think I understand why. No.
And I'm responsible.
Yeah.
I am now responsible to complete this action. Whatever started me off, a premonition, an inspiration.
Comes through you.
Whatever. Whatever it is, it grabs me and takes
comes
all of it.
Comes through you and to you and only for you.
This is meeting number 128 of the Jellicoe Literary Guild. Welcome. It's the 24th since we started doing it again a few years ago. And I have found sometimes over the years that the smaller number of people meetings are, they have their own charm to them. Because there's less of a crowd energy and more of an intimate one. So that's cool. We'll see how that goes tonight. We're going to start with the Jellicoe Guild flashbacks. I'll play them in a row, but I'll preface them in advance. And they run from way back to rather recently. I didn't realize, Tom, but you've only been coming for a year. I think we were reading your poems here even before you came because they were in the Cenacle. So we were reading your poems before you actually were here in person. That's really funny, I think. The first of the five is a friend of mine that used to come when the meetings were down in New Britain. His name, Mark Bergeron. We were very tight for many years. Really good writer, and he was also a guitar player. And the song we're going to hear I think he explains that the music is from the 50s, but the lyrics, he wrote lyrics to some old music. And my friend Jim plays along with him, harmonizes. The next one we're going to hear is me reading. I was thinking of Joe, you in particular. I was thinking that, Tom, I was thinking that you guys hear my poems from recent vintage a lot. So this is me reading a poem that I wrote back in 98. So it's a poem from many years ago. And probably similar in different ways. The third one is Cassie reading poems by the, I don't know if he's Czechoslovakian, he's Eastern European, the poet Czesław Miłosz. And then the next one is Joe Coleman from October of 2012 reading one of his poems. And the last one is Tom reading a poem by another friend of mine. I asked you to read a poem of my friend Joe Chacon, and you graciously did it. So here we go.
This is called Sleepwalking. These are like 50 songs written now.
Yeah.
This is, I wrote the music was written in the 50s. I wrote a vocal part to it. I know those lyrics.
Come with me to a moment that's meant to be. We'll serenade with the stars on the sleepwalk after dark. Time has gone far away like two lovers kiss. We'll share all the things we miss on the sleepwalk after dark. Oh, hold me so close that all the birds seem to sing in time. Kiss, kiss my lips. Share our love divine. When we're gone, love will play a sweet refrain, and lovers meet in the park on a sweet walk after dark. Oh, hold me so close that all the birds seem to sing in time. Kiss my lips, share our love divine. Come with me to a moment that's meant to be. We'll sail away with the stars on a sea fog after dark.
Yeah.
This poem is called Resurrection Now, and I finished it on my birthday of this year. It begins with an epigraph from Rainer Maria Rilke, which reads, "A work of art is good if it is arisen out of necessity." There is the bell-shaped manuscript. There is a manuscript, bell-shaped, and that shines. Chimes swinging, chimes rusting, chimes swinging and running, chimes increasingly invisible. Chimes singing now, death notes, working the mechanisms of time. Rusting, singing, more vital, less invisible. Resurrection now, settle in, friends, are you ready? One. He said, entropy is the boa constrictor of reality, and played an E major seventh chord, smiling and grim. I looked at her, placidity's pinkest smile, weightless silence. She felt no doubt, no interest, no need. Crowds are unnecessary, was what he meant. Bass guitar speak, frowning biblical dialect. I trusted her, smiling weightless silence. Two. He said, entropy abhors creativity, and offered me a tab and a pill and a sandwich and a prayer. I looked at her and she was more apparent than ever. I looked at her and she was not a yes, she was a now. So now I'm crowded with voices, lousy with doubt, lousy with hope. If there's a song in me, I'm too fucked to know. Three. He said, entropy equals Satan, and went on looking at the sky where now I saw holes of hope and he didn't. I looked at her and she was gone. She was gone and I wouldn't find her, now or ever. I had failed. There is no sky. There are no doubts. There is a God fluttering in our hands. There is morning dew. There are chimes. Four. He said, entropy sucks, and cracked open his beer and walked back into the house. I wondered where she was. I knew that somewhere she danced. I was immolation, loud and brief. Just drinking a beer with the wasting night, now, just lying on the lawn, singing, just lying to myself. Five. He said, God doesn't like entropy, and neither do I, and he started drinking, too, burning, convincing. I wanted her back, whatever way. I was a whore now, beaten. I was a train beyond timetables and tracks. Lying to myself, lying on the lawn, a whore beneath the fragment sky. Take me, take me, take me. Six. He said, organize particles as beautifully as possible, and he warned me I was not a gone challenge. She's beyond particles, gone girl god, beyond sky, now thickening, now descending. She, light, release. Holes in the sky thickening, I'm ready. The cosmic mind thickening top, I'm ready. Spirit, galaxial ocean, soft, I'm ready. Seven, he said, entropy hates when you do this, and watched a local college drunk point a stained finger at me. The sky recedes and I am restless in the grass, but the sky is broken, pieces are falling. She hits me again, again, thudding, smiling. The sin in this world is world enjoyed. I am burned, naked, become her ruby virgin. A nightgown floats away, a pink, wordy smoke. Eight, she said, everybody's selling out to entropy. Are you selling out too cheaply? And disappeared. Nobody was left in the yard, not Jeremiah, not Mary Muse, not even Joe Gin Blossom College. I failed to sing in the language of sky, too eager, too ego, time, I guess, to go inside. Nine. He said, the more you fight it, the more it fights you. No, really, had written this on his wall. Wanting her back is not about time or space, Eros, mortality. She is blood. She is song. She is cosmos. I am following in the carnal wind her dancing causes. She has become my pink-cheeked theism. Resurrection now, are you listening to me? Am I? Resurrection now, chimes and manuscripts, singing bells of dust, memories of great abundance and evaporating forests, omnipotent kisses and shadowing hands to more. Resurrection now, are you ready? Hung up on the beam, buried in the hill, trapped in the
Michael Gordon and his God.
burned alive
with
an electric light.
God is gold in your mouth and you are chewing it more.
It's like Michael Jordan is not.
Shines in the other. Many props are made.
Lance, God is back.
Don't easy on the first.
You
let's hear restart.
The resurrection now. Signs in the desert. Manuscripts tossed in night train. Bound for the west, passing a carriage bearing your soul going east. No wheels, no horses, no driver. Careening sparks, levitating attention, girl gods, and flailing hearts. 10. He said we're all agents of entropy and offered me a pipe, smiling, my friend. She is not really gone. She is waiting in my cavern of shadows. She is nude, humming, watching me. The dead sing about the eyes of the world, and I am tripping. I am crying. I am let it serve thee. I am shit nothing. 11. He picked up his guitar and strummed a G major 7th chord by way of this point. He watches me listen. She holds me in my cave and her arms amongst her skin, still humming. I want to say, I will be her pink gown. 12. He said, we're here to fight entropy, and he lit a cigarette and began to shut down as many machines. She said, you cannot be my pink gown. You must be my manuscript. You know this. I must be your times. You know this. I know this, my girl god. You are absent, my girl god, tonight. But I hear your chimes, my love, and my manuscript replies. 13. He said, beauty annoys entropy, and pointed at my manuscript, and his guitar rang out, E major 7. She is always leaving me, the way the night always leaves, the way my dreams squeeze my heart. I know I am emptying. I know I am changing. I know I am transforming. I am filling up with you. Resurrection now. The fines in the street lamps have long known. The spirits in the cemetery, too. Resurrection now. You are in the eyes of the world. You are bells. You are ringing louder every day. Resurrection now. There's nothing else left to do. You're rising. Pay attention. You're rising. Resurrection now. The lights in every street, empty street, are singing it. Noise and symphonies, badgers and rock. Resurrection now. No need to drink or to drop or to dose or to shoot or to point. Resurrection now. The big bang in your chest. In your chest is trying to tell. Eliminate the unnecessary. Resurrection now. Practice singing. Make it undifferentiation. Love thy neighbors as thyself. Drink him up. Suck her down. 14. He said, our value is in how anthropic we are. Tossed me a blanket, left me in darkness. I am in bed now. I am in a coffin now. I close my eyes, dream past psychedelia. I am waiting for the chimes. The road toward dawn appears. The sunrise is pink, laughs, sings my name. I am young again. I will find her. I begin to run. The end.
Thank you, Rick.
I haven't seen you like that in ages. Thank you.
They are by, have you heard of Chipmunk Moosh?
Yeah, I don't think
he's Lithuanian.
Uh-huh.
He lived during World War II in, he was in Warsaw, wasn't he? In Warsaw.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in Warsaw.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, 89. He was a professor at Berkeley
mm-hmm.
for a very long time. I think he said that he lived in Berkeley for the, that was his longest time living anywhere.
Mm-hmm. He read all his stuff. We just read through a lot of his stuff.
So I have two very short books. And it was very interesting reading his, to read what he wrote before the war,
yep.
what he wrote during the war, mm-hmm. and then afterwards, and then especially like in late life, he just kind of got grumpy.
Yeah, he got grumpy.
Like, I've lived a long time. And it was very noticeable. His poems were just not as good, but not because they were poorly written, just because they were grumpy. He was an mm-hmm. old, grumpy
Thank
man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so two short poems, and then we can share your poems.
Mm-hmm.
This one's called Faith. Faith is in you whenever you look at a dewdrop or a floating leaf, and know that they are because they have to be. Even if you close your eyes and dream of things, the world will remain as it has always been, and the leaf will be carried by the waters of the river. You have faith also when you hurt your foot against a sharp rock, and you know that rocks are here to hurt our feet. See the long shadow that is cast by the tree? We and the flowers throw shadows on the earth. What has no shadow has no strength to live. And that was written in Warsaw in 1943. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting time to be writing a poem about faith. Mm-hmm. And the other one that I like by him is called Hope. And it's Hope is with you when you believe the earth is not a dream but living flesh, that sight, touch, and hearing do not lie, that all things you have ever seen here are like a garden looked at from a gate. You cannot enter, but you're sure it's there. Could we but look more clearly and wisely, we might discover something in the garden, a strange new flower and an unnamed star. Some people say we should not trust our eyes, that there is nothing, just a seeming. These are the ones who have no hope. They think that the moment we turn away, the world behind our back ceases to exist, as if snatched up by the hands of thieves. And that was also written in Warsaw, 1943. Very.
Did he write in Polish?
Lithuanian. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he translated them, so they're interesting that mm-hmm. they are his own translations, which are, I think, hard, very hard to translate your own work into a different language. So.
He did it.
This is a prose piece. It's about my painting, Juanita.
What is it called?
Painting Juanita.
Mm-hmm. And what is it?
I don't think that's going to happen.
Oh, okay.
This is a mention, I think I'm going to mention it to describe it to you. This, I want you to just think of this as a voiceover for a film noir type of a movie. Okay. It's kind of a performance. It's kind of a performance piece, but I've never really done it the way it needs to be done, but someday I will. Thank you, Juanita. She had a great face, especially from behind. I could only imagine what she looked like with all her clothes on, but I had to know for sure. If you don't mind, please describe what you look like without your clothes on. Another guy might have said, take off your clothes, but I wouldn't presume. We'd only been married a few months. I guess I look like a naked woman, she answered with that strange look in her good eye. Ah, I thought, a naked woman. Apparently that's the same thing as a woman without her clothes on. She'd given me an important clue. I've never seen a naked woman, I admitted. She went into the bathroom and motioned me to think. She went into the bedroom and motioned me to follow. Well, I've got something to show you, she cried. Slowly she slipped out of her construction boots. Do all women have 12 toes and webbed feet? I wondered aloud. They do in my family. Then, if we have a daughter, she'll have 2 extra toes and webbed feet. I wanted her to know I'd been listening. I wanted her to know I could extrapolate a future involving sexual relations. And a little girl who could swim like a duck. Maybe we'd call her Daisy. Would you like to have sex, Brett? She was smiling. I wasn't going to spoil my chances by reminding her my name is Joe, so I simply eagerly nodded. Okay, but be quick. Don't use all the Kleenex. I've written. Paint me in the nude, she commanded when I came out of the bathroom. Nude? What does that mean? I had to know. It means naked, without any clothes on, she answered. It was another clue. God, yes, yes, God, yes, I chose. I'd love to paint you in the nude. And take off your clothes, she said. I'll get into a costume. She tricked me, I think. It was quite a painting, though. Juanita, in one of her Viking helmets and a hoop skirt, Kevlar vest, holding hedge clippers in one hand and a jar of strawberry jam in another, and a complete set of the Warren Commission Report volumes in yet another hand. Juanita, exactly as she appeared the night we met at the Republican National Convention. Or was that Emily? Or was it the prayer group? Oh well, whatever. I didn't mind catching the cold painting Juanita without my clothes on. Me, naked, nude. In our drafty apartment, painting Juanita. It was worth it. my vocabulary had two new words. Maybe I'd see a woman with other clothes on eventually. Maybe even my wife. But not today. That was more than a year ago. I know one who loves me. On our first anniversary, our paper anniversary, she gave me my very own box of Kleenex and a dictionary. What did I give her? Was it to you, your cop? Now we're expecting our first child, even though the neighbors say we don't get trick-or-treaters in May. I still haven't seen her. I still haven't seen a woman without her clothes on. But I still really, 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 really want to. It's just so silly. I love being silly. I hear there are magazines with photos. I hear there are magazines with photos of women without their clothes on, but I'd be ashamed if Juanita found National Geographic under the bed. Someday I'll solve the mystery. I just want to know why men and women look so different in sweaters.
Tom, I'd like to make a request of you. Yeah. There's a poem here by a friend of mine named Joe Saccone on page 115. It's a poem about his family. And I think it might be pleasurable to hear it read in your tones. This is a guy I went to graduate school with. He's Italian from Jersey. And he's now a doctor up here in Boston. I think this poem, I think you might enjoy reading this poem aloud.
North Jersey afternoon. In the grand rooms of my childhood home, the old Italian men moved deliberately in 1979. I was happily at play in the spotless sun, in a patch of blazing yellow on the yellow carpet. In a tangle of tin trays, I spied their casual suits, their cigars burning a scent of home, which rose like the smoke of my locomotives, barreling across imagined trestles in those days of imagination. The talk was light as the Yankees were fair. Homesick Munson had crashed his plane. Someone had tickets from a business relation, and so they held forth for hours in that sun. As the sun tracked shadows one thing on those long floors of home, and the demitasse cups clinked gently on the porcelain saucers, the conversation quieted. Were more urgent in tone. Those stout voices turned, each one toward a center point somewhere above their grapes and walnuts. Consensus was reached. It would be done. The old Italian men were deliberate in 1979. Thank you. Thank you.
That's
a first pass, huh?
That was a good first pass. That poem is not completely different from some of your poems.
Yeah, yeah.
Very descriptive, yeah. Very much a scene, and grabbing the handles. Out of the past, into the present. Here we go. Brand new, June 2014.
Gracias.
For three for me, just in case. Ordinarily, I would start the reading usually with my piece at the front. However, I'm going to go backwards this time around because I'm going to save that piece in the front for later. And I'm going to save my first reading for later. I'm going to invite you guys to go first. So, Joe, I invite you to... It's nice that you're sitting right there, because I was thinking in my mind, I'd like to invite Joe to read first.
That's the way you wanted to go, eh?
Yeah.
All right.
That's what I was anticipating.
All righty. Eskimo Jesus.
This is by request. I love this one.
Yeah, Ray requested this, but it was written. But it was written from, because you gave me a suggestion about writing out of dreams.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I really like this poem that answered.
Yeah. Ray had given me, you know, Ray and I will sometimes converse over the phone when he's walking between Oak Grove and 122. And we have really good conversations during that time. And among Ray's suggestion was to, well, keep a journal, keep a dream journal, and try to write out of your dreams. Now, this is not an immediate dream I had, but it's very much based on a dream I had had long, long ago that did involve Jesus. And I just brought a little bit more of my current circumstances to this dream in order to write this. And I wanted to write something that was just very, I don't know, dreamlike. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted there to be an underpinning of respectable religiosity to it. So you may pick up on some of the gospel inclusions here. Mm-hmm. Because I think at first glance it might seem a little blasphemous. It is not. It is not blasphemous. Eskimo Jesus with tattoos paddles his rowboat along the Thames into my reverie. His oars, long-handled mirrors, reflected the divinity in his face. Stereophonic, I watched from both shores, hoping he would begin to sing. Many crowds had gathered. They all looked like ideas. They spoke the mystic tongue only deaf people comprehend, a language I imagined I once knew. The idea crowds had not gathered to watch Eskimo Jesus with tattoos. They had come to fill reverie with possibility. If they had been believers, they might have prayed, "Sing, Eskimo Jesus with tattoos. Sing a song about mourning and belonging." But they were not believers. Eskimo Jesus with tattoos kept paddling. Eskimo Jesus with tattoos kept paddling as the Thames curved into and out of itself, becoming an enormous, watery, Arabic numeral 8. Eskimo Jesus with tattoos pulled in his oars and let the currents take him around and around and in and out. Eventually the crowds drifted away till there were no ideas. I too went home to be about my father's business. However, for the remainder of the daydream, I was singing, "It's nice to wake beside you, to greet today together, to place my arms about you, my sky embracing sunlight, my father harmonizing."
That is a beautiful moment, though.
Thank you.
And you really hit it at the end.
Thank you. Thank you very
really,
much.
You really hit it at the end. You know how you know when you're done? When you write a line like that.
Yeah.
Then you're done.
When I was.
When you write a line like that, that last line.
My father harmonized. My sky embracing sunlight. My father harmonized.
Because there's nothing more to say. There's nothing more to say that it would not be a step down or redundant.
Yeah, well, just FYI, my father was a wonderful singer, and he could harmonize. And to the extent that I can sing, it's because of my father. Now, my father and I were not traditionally close. And, but the best of me comes from him. You know, which is not to say the worst of me comes from Mom. Dad was okay. Dad did his best, but that's really not, you know, this is about the relationship between Father and Son, and God the Father and God the Son. kind of all mixed up into, you know, kind of all mixed up into one. And I don't know how it turned in. Yeah, there's a
you can't move yourself.
There's a whimsical.
But it's an undertone. It's not. Primarily.
Thank God it's only undertone. Yeah.
But you know,
I would not want somebody to laugh at this.
No. It's just one of the melodies. It's one of the tones.
It's a part of the harmony. Only God. So here's the next one. The next one is more. I could talk an awful lot about
this. This is the one we were telling about earlier, Tom, about Icarus.
This one I call Daedalus in Grief. Icarus, my son, sprang from these loins, but in captivity I gave you life and fashioned wings, feathers fixed with wax, strapped along our arms, across our backs, to fly together so we might live free, free of that tower and the king of Crete, for whom I built the maze. Wings to hoist us upwards as we gazed at Oceanus underneath our sandaled feet. Wings. I fabricated power by which we would at last escape King Minos' lofty tower. I warned you, Icarus, my child. Be mindful of sea spray. It adds to what wings weigh. Fly not too low. You merely smiled. I cautioned you, be wary of the heat and not to fly too high, too high, where Apollo burns white seagull and black crow, where sunlight will melt wax. Your wings will break apart. Ah, Icarus, you could not wait to start. The sky was in your eyes, the sky Pegasus flies, the sky filled up your heart. Icarus, my boy, you were the first to quit the parapet. As I, your father, filled with pride, watched my son rise and swoop and glide in temporary joy. Past Lebanthos, the Isle of Delos, confident. Father and son, we soared towards Sicily. And when Aeolus lifted us upon his breath, impetuous, you climbed where Phaeton went, heedless of Apollo's scorching glance. Your youthful exultation brought you a wet death. It brought this grief to me. I watched you plummet down in a descending dance. Icarus, my son, I saw you fall. I heard your desperate call. Oh, Icarus, I saw you drown. Briny waves had feathers floating on their crests. Plumage for the sea as I continued west. Icarus, my firstborn, only one. Oh, Icarus, beloved, sorry son. Your father mourns on this Sicilian shore, desolate and destitute, for I shall hold you nevermore. No, Icarus, I should have made a parachute instead of pinion pairs. Or better yet, we could have simply walked downstairs.
I just don't think that second ending takes anything away from the good lines that you like so much. I mean, I just don't think it I don't think it cheapens it at all or anything.
Yeah, that definitely was a concern, and I said that to Ray one evening we were talking, and I said I did not want to cheapen it because no. I mean I think for me the fundamental emotion was supposed to be the grief, and I thought that anything that was clever or witty or...
I wasn't being clever or witty. I mean, it's him expressing... He was a smart man, and he was expressing his grief in...
Yeah. He's an architect, too.
In regret. Yeah.
And you know what happened subsequent to this, I found out as I was doing the research? He was also a very, very proud and jealous man. And his sister's son invented a, I think it was a compass. Perdix was the name of the nephew. And
these guys were mythological.
Oh, yeah, all mythological.
Okay.
But Daedalus was so jealous of his nephew.
Inventing the compass. Yeah.
Well, whatever it was he invented,
yeah. Uh-huh.
That he changed him to a flightless bird, partridge.
He had those kind of powers. I said he was an architect, not a magician.
Well, this is this is the funny thing about myths.
Yeah.
But I thought that this may be part of the an important part of the meaning of the entire story of Daedalus, you know, that in spite of what had happened to his son, you know, he could still be angry, he could still deny flight to his sister's son, that he would still be jealous. He was an engineer. Daedalus was an engineer.
Yeah, an architect.
Yeah.
Or an engineer.
Engineer, architect, maybe both. Maybe both, yeah.
So, wait, when you say denied flight, how do you deny flight to a man?
Changed the nephew into a partridge.
Oh, into a bird. Literally into a bird.
Into a flightless bird, yeah.
Because of his invention. Because he came up with something clever.
And he was so jealous that that his nephew had come up with something that he hadn't. You know?
And then there was the wonderful story of King Minos' pursuit of Daedalus.
Uh-huh. Not familiar with that at all.
It's great. So, Icarus died.
Yeah.
At least in one of the many versions of the myth. He died in the water.
Yeah.
And Daedalus kept going.
Yeah, to Sicily.
Because he was essentially escaping. I mean, the whole point of these wings was that it was an escape route
out
of the tower of the island.
Yeah.
So, he continues to escape. And then he kind of kind of goes undercover. I mean, goes in disguise because he can't reveal who he is, apparently. Maybe the populations were smaller then or something. But he has to be disguised. So King Minos is in pursuit of him and offers, you know, reward for the big bad architect guy. But then realizes that Daedalus is so smart that he's going to have to lure him out. So what he does is he's in Athens or Sicily or I don't know, he's one of those places. Greece, right?
Well, I know he first landed on Sicily, but I don't know where he might have gone from there. Yeah.
So, in pursuit of Daedalus, King Minos offers a reward for like a shell, like a seashell. How do you string a seashell? No. How do you draw a string through a seashell?
Yeah, I guess you have to kind of pierce a hole. You've got to very gingerly grind a hole.
There's a hole there.
Is there already a hole?
I mean, in a chrysalis? Is that what it's called?
Conch shell.
Conch shell, yeah. Yeah, there's like a tiny...
Oh, in a conch, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it was a test that had to do with drawing a string through it. And he knew only a really smart man would be able to figure out the answer. It involves an ant.
I
don't know exactly what he did with the ant, but the ant drew the string through
through the hole.
Probably maybe it was lured by honey or something.
Where is this found?
It's in the myths.
But which version of the myth?
I have no idea. I read these things online. People could make them up for all I know.
Yeah, because I mean, all I get is...
But Goldfinch's mythology or Bullfinch's mythology?
It's not in Bullfinch.
Okay.
It's not in Bullfinch.
But that's
it's not in LaRousse.
Oh, how about Edith Hamilton?
No, she's the briefest of them all.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to try to find that because that's fascinating. But remember,
and so he lured him out.
No, fool.
Yeah, he lured him out because he was the only one able to figure out to sleep.
And then what happened?
I don't know. I mean, he didn't kill him. I think they just probably beat each other up or something.
Couldn't Minos? Oh, no, I sometimes confuse Minos with Midas.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, that's good to know.
Yeah.
I bet you didn't know about the nephew being turned into a
bondage. I did not know about the nephew.
Yeah, and that's in Bullfinch.
And all I can say to you is that Greek mythology is fucking fascinating.
Oh, it's incredible.
The thing I find addictive about them or about their approach is that because they have absolutely no they have no adherence to a single story.
Right.
That has to be the way. Mm. It frees you up to tell as many versions of something as you want to strike your fancy. If you want to tell more versions of things,
sure.
If you want to contradict yourself on purpose, I mean, the Greeks give you license to essentially say that the idea of modern narrative with a single line from A to Z, throw it out.
But I do have to say, I really think that in Greek mythology, in the most accepted versions, and maybe the most concise versions, there are the rudiments of our contemporary understanding of psychology.
Oh, sure.
I really do. You know, I think we've got virtually everything, all the hang-ups, all of the fixations, you know, all of the dysfunctions, all the aberrations. They can all be found in Greek. And I think these were smart.
Yeah, they were totally smart. Yeah. Smart, and they wrote it down.
And they wrote it all down. Because this was the way they were trying to make sense of things, you know?
Yeah.
What's the aspiration of humankind? To rise above itself, whether it be on Pegasus, you know, Bellerophon, you know, Phaeton riding his chariot, whatever the case may be, to transcend, you know? But what holds us down, you know? And it's, you know, you'll love it. Good stuff. But, Tom, now you're back, and I wanted to ask you, this poem here, this Daedalus in Greek, the last few lines. Briny waves had feathers floating on their crests, plumage for the sea, as I continued west. And that was where I really wanted to stop this poem. But I foolishly submitted some additional material to Cassie and Ray because I wanted to amuse them. And what I submitted was the following. Well, the thing was, I just loved the line, plumage for the sea. I just loved the line, plumage for the sea. And I wanted it to end there, and I continued west. Boom!
But then he has bonus lines, which I like a lot. And I like them because as I continue, or we could, what is it, or we could have just walked downstairs.
We could have simply walked downstairs.
And the reason why I like that, you tell me what you think, but the reason why I like that is because up to that point, Joe Coleman has been doing this wonderful, wonderful retelling of this myth and has adhered to the details even as he did put his own style on it. Those last lines about, or we could have just walked downstairs, that's 21st century Joe Coleman commenting on the whole thing.
Really?
That's him, like, stepping back in some kind of meta way and saying, you know what, this is a magnificent myth that has captured my mind and my heart, but there's an element of it that just, like, niggles at me. There's something here that just, like, there was an option here that we didn't take. Something like that. It's a Joe Coleman commentary on what Joe Coleman has done. What the myth did. It's like, what do you think, Tom?
You think there's a term for that?
It involves the word meta. That's all I can think. Metafiction, metapoetry. It might not be that, but that's how I thought of it.
Because I think that's the kind of thing that I try to get to. I tried to get to something like that.
Okay.
Summation can be falling off the log, jamming the period home, you know, the end of the log.
Yep.
And it can be either one.
Yep. And he does it twice here. He does it twice here. See, what it reminds me of is like hearing a good guitarist and you've been listening to him solo for 10 minutes, and then he finishes and the room is silent, and then he adds a little flourish. Because he can. Because he's in the mood, because the moment is there, and because he hits it. Because
that's precious too.
Yeah.
That's precious time.
When I read those additional lines, I thought to myself, it's a double ending. You could have ended previously, but I like it that it has this additional flourish, because that's just power. That's just power and beauty, and it's also humility, because obviously you were so enthralled by this poem, by this story, that you just, like, it's like you couldn't end it.
Yeah.
You were just enamored of it.
I think when I started writing, I told you this on the phone. I said, when I started this, I had an idea of, it was a whole different poem about friends being parachutes and they let you down gently and easily, you know, when you fall through life.
You're a leap, huh?
And I kind of like the idea, you know, parachutes is a pretty word.
Yeah.
It's an easy word to say, easy word to read. So I knew I wanted to use that, you know. And so parachutes was probably in here somewhere as I started doing the Icarus myth, you know. So I'm glad I kind of, yeah, and I, you know, I knew what you thought when I heard Cassie agreed with you. Now I'm hearing Tom agree. I say, all right, so be it.
You were in custody.
I might have been out of control. Yeah.
I will introduce Tom by saying that once a year, I ask him to send me stories. I think of it as a special treat because I know that he writes so much that for him to reduce it down to just 5 or 6 stories to send to me, it's a way for me to have an insight into your mind. To just see what you choose, because you write so much, for you to choose amongst that. And I read them all with great pleasure. And then I always find the one that fits. And this one was just perfect.
This is, in my mind, connected with The Rescues of Bertrand Corvallis. Stop a Kidnapping.
Mm-hmm.
The one about the bike race, when the guy leading the Pan Mass Challenge veers down the side street and his whole gang follows him, stopping a kidnap.
Mm.
I got 4 of them. And the ending of this one is the same thing you went through. This story.
Okay.
Caitlin, toll gate collector. I hope my voice carries, because again, I forgot my hearing aids, and I don't generally use them at home.
Right now I'm hearing you okay. You hearing me?
Yeah.
Sounds good.
The sun angling into her eyes had come up like thunder out of China across the bay. And even as Caitlin Bordeaux made music of the poet's words, she couldn't remember his name. Nothing was right in the scene, though the day had begun in promise. Nick had just gone through mere minutes earlier, the load piled high on his flatbed rig. Most of the night, the truck had been parked in front of her house. The neighbors probably talking again. She didn't care. His mouth still alive on her. Now here's this turkey of a traveler playing music as loud as it was damned oppressive. A 98 Nissan Maxima gray 4-door. She had identified every car for a whole year and they hadn't dropped a bill or a coin in months. Why would some idiot heathen play music as if it were leading a marching band in? Obnoxious music to begin with. Something in the day was going to bother her. She just knew it. Why wasn't the loud music ever something she loved? Some Puccini, something with body to it, her decent dream song. In the backseat of the Maxima, she saw the piled-up blanket moving with slight jerks, some living thing in motion. 1,001 sights she'd seen in her 2 years here, catching coin and currency. People in the back seat swapping papers, so still they looked dead. Once a huge snake sunning at a rear window. Surprises were never too far away. Obviously, this was another one. She wouldn't even hazard a guess. The monoxide fumes swirled through the door and her own cubicle exhaust system sucked them up. But the stream passed around her, touched her. Every time out, it made her think of Bill Gennaro's garage back home in Indiana. They'd lived upstairs for 10 years in the oil and gas room, and the smell of car rot she thought were environmental, were part of the universe. It came again with the Maxima, hard for a car only 4 years old. Would the fumes cling at her skin, age her quicker than another job? In one glance, she looked at the mirror, propped up in place on each shift she came to work. Some of the collectors kidded her about it. Only Chauncey in the next booth had refrained from ragging on her. Every day, thousands of people handed her money and looked at her, eyes at times so leveled and so degrading, she'd want to smack them. 34 she was, and holding on for the ride. So far, there was but the hint of wrinkles and a thin line curving down beside her nose and getting lost at the corner of her mouth. The teeth of her smile were attractive, she believed, which made her smile reassuringly and interdictate, making visible its demands. Blue eyes, holding a bit of pain as always, might give her away if she let them. Nick said she was goddamn beautiful, but how could she count on that? Didn't he smell of oil and gasoline and the fumes that 18-wheelers seemed to lug in their wakes forever, invisible tails of huge road comets? It was a $10 bill the man in the 98 Maxima had handed her, a good-looking guy. Maybe 50, gray hair, but eyes out of a grandstand. Deep, labored, bedeviled. She hunted for more of the poet's words, but the music could have killed her. A diamond on one of the driver's fingers, she thought, could pay off the mortgage. She made a face at the music, but he didn't make a move to turn it down. Then her heart leaped. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the high-crowned blanket move in the back seat. It fell partly away from what it was draped on, and she saw a little blonde girl poking a straw through the bars of a small cage, even as she handed the man his change. Her heart leaped into her throat. She thought of her daughter Mercy still in bed at home, and her own mother sleeping in the next room. The man looked into her eyes even as he stepped on the gas pedal. The Maxima jumped out and offered on the turnpike. The panic was on, in the bloodstream, her heart jamming her throat. Nick was up the road ahead of the Maxima, the next exit about 12 miles away. Nick, with a lovely mouth, with the great hands, was the only hope. The only hope Caitlin Bordeaux made her move. The only hope. Caitlin Bordeaux made her move. Screaming for Chauncey DeWitt in the next booth, she scared hell out of a man and a woman in a 95 Chevy. She grabbed her cell phone and dialed Nick's number, praying he had his phone on. She held up one finger as Chauncey ran to her booth, and she stepped outside. Cars plugged the lane. The fumes were rampant. She held a hand up for Chauncey to listen. Nick answered. Listen, Nick, life or death. If you want to see me again, listen. The man was in a voice, in its ascension, that breathless whiff. She tried to shake the scream out of it. Behind you, maybe 3 or 4 minutes, a gray 98 Maxima. Man at the wheel. He's got a little girl in a cage under a blanket in his back seat, and he's playing music loud enough to drown out her cries. He started to say something, but she wouldn't let him. And Chauncey DeWitt ran off to get his own cell phone. Traffic had slowed. Now 3 gates were stopped tight. If he gets to the next exit, that little girl could be lost forever. She had to tell a lie. I called home. There's no answer. It could be Mercy. I don't know. She hoped it was a lie. Oh, God in heaven, wouldn't punish her for such a little lie. Nick's voice boomed back. What the hell can I do, Katie? I can't stop him. What did you call me for? What the hell can I do? Nick could choke every time he thought of her. His breath made his hole hide in his gut, waiting to blow him up. He thought her so lovely, how her hips would mound, how her mound would hip him. Driving the long days in the road, he would play the little games of memory, the recall of taste and wonder, the softest touch coming in a moment of such clarity you could spend hours thinking about her, recreating it, the road spinning out ahead of him, apparently in absolute control. Now it was done for sure, just screaming in his ear, making new demands. God damn it, Nick, stop the truck, block traffic. Don't be afraid of a goddamn ticket. His voice was ascending. The stadies aren't going to hire you. Stop the damn traffic. Make a roadblock. It's a little girl, Nick. I swear to God, you'll never see me again if he gets away with her. It's only 12 miles to exit 5. Chauncey was on his phone and waving at her, pointing back down the road and up the road and then overhead. It was as if he were on the television explaining to an audience what was going on. He rushed over to her. Move. Katie, you sure? His hand was over the phone and his eyes were wide. But he was a new grandfather and a former Marine. A Nick solid man. A rock solid man. Balding and rugged and smiling a lot. He never ribbed her about looks. Never asked embarrassing questions. He'd come out of the far-flung jungles of Vietnam where he'd made life and death decisions by the hundreds, sometimes every day. Kicking in was the old adrenaline on the loose, the "you are it" pin tagged on his chest. The M16 seemed to be frozen in his hands again. The plea in her eyes came universal, the mother's plea, and the knowledge of thousands of years of motherhood. He bet on her. I saw him and the kid, Lieutenant. Is that you, Bubba? Yes, I saw him myself. 98 Maxim, a gray, four-door, music playing loud as hell like he was drowning out a cry. Son of a bitch, I get him, I'll kill that bastard. It had been perhaps 7 minutes since Nick had left, Caitlin thought. 12 miles to the next exit. If he did 70 to 80, that Maxim could be there in minutes. The girl gone forever. It was up to Nick. She wondered what kind of a father he'd make. Now he had the chance to show her. In the diamond tee, the flatbed behind him, piled with new but empty pallets, Nick prayed and saw the sign saying exit 5 was half a mile away. Never had he met anybody like Katie in his 12 years on the road. Whenever he got to her place, it was like coming home. That had to be important. If he went by the exit, let the guy and the kid get away from him, she'd know somehow. That truth snapped through him like a whip. The shift knob fitted into his hand, firm as her breast. The marvel of Caitlin Bordeaux came over him once more. His feet began to dance on the pedals, the gears taking on a new hum, the light load shifting slightly, and Nick Preedon pointing into the floor to a trucker he was about to pass. He could have been saying anything, but was obviously in need of some help. The brake pedal banged against his foot. The load shifted with a slight creaking easily, like a snake on the grass, and the diamond tee began a hitching slowdown on the turnpike. The newly cut grass at the exit popped up just ahead on his right, and the overpass beyond it where exit 5 raced off to the west. 4 American flags snapped in the morning air above the overpass chain link fence. The Kenworth rig beside him, one that Nick had seen before with a state of Maine map on their driver's door, ground slowly to a halt with him. Behind them came the screech of brakes, harsh screams coming off the pavement, but there were no impact sounds. Traffic stopped. Nick stepped down from his cab and looked behind him, back down the road toward the toll plaza, almost 12 miles behind him. The traffic all along the pike was coming to a standstill. On a crown of the road, over a quick rise, vehicles coming to a crawl looked like dominoes edging into line. A man leaped out of his car immediately behind Nick's rig. It's on the radio. Some son of a bitch has a kid in a cage in his car between here and the last toll plaza, unless he got past us and took this exit. The guy on the radio said the police are sending out a helicopter and they're coming down here from exit 5. Says the guy is playing music loud enough to kill you. The man looked back over his shoulder. Nick looked. The driver of the Miss Kenworth looked. They could hear the music like 100 boomboxes at work. And down the median strip, speeding on the narrow grass plot, careening, swerving in and out of sudden swales and slips, came the gray Maxima, the heavy music leaping out front of it like the blast of trumpets. Nick looked at his rig. He'd never get it across the median in time. Morning traffic was going in the opposite direction. The man who talked about the radio announcement looked at him. All around them, people were out of their cars, some yelling, some saying, kidnap, loud music, some complaining and swearing. The man behind Nick leaped into his car and pulled it broadside across the median just as the Maxima came up out of another sleep, deep swale and stalled on the crest of ground. The man in the gray Maxima leaped out of his car and heard sirens in the distance. Their wheel is harsh and it's cutting and screamed. When he tried to jump back into the car, half a dozen men pinned him against the side door. Nick pulled open the back door, put the blankets off the cage, unlocked the top and picked up the little girl. She screamed in his ears and struggled, and he showed her to people gathered around him. A grandmotherly woman reached for the child and held her in her arms. The woman kept shaking her head and clutching the little girl against her bosom. Chauncey DeWitt, standing in front of 10 miles of backed up traffic at the toll plaza, danced across the pavement, waving his arms at Caitlin. He had the phone at his ear. People were all over the road, the radio still blasting out the news alert. Chauncey had called the local radio station. A gutsy early morning disc jockey and news broadcast had jumped the news with an instant headline for the morning travelers. Here's in-process news breaking for travelers northbound between Parkman Toll Plaza and Exit 5. A kidnapping is in process right now. A man in a 98 gray Maxima playing loud music as a small girl in a cage in the backseat of his car. Don't let him get off the road at Exit 5. It could be your kid he is. He kept saying the same thing. The police had been called. The wheels had turned. Caitlin Bordeaux, late that night, heard the engine of the Diamond G grind to a halt. Air escaped the connection line. A door slammed with a solid dunk, and Nick Predon's footsteps on the walkway moving toward her. Mercy sat sleeping on her lap as she had for 2 hours. The night light on, shadows bouncing around them, a few neighbors' lights throwing off a warm glow.
But I think there's something else that you're doing, too, and it's done so effectively, is that you've got people here and here and here. They're separated, and yet they're connected.
Mm, totally.
You know? And it's like, and you pull that off so exquisitely, you know?
There's the locale.
Yeah.
I told you.
Yes.
Yeah, and I had a buddy, God rest him now. All he can remember was toll gates is the pigeon shit on the top. That's all he remembered.
I was caught in from the title. The title caught me.
Yeah.
I like the title. The title made me interested.
Yeah.
Everybody goes through toll gates.
Yeah.
And you had named one. Usually we don't know their names.
Yeah.
So it was a very nice, simple, but grabbing title.
I noticed, you were talking about that song lyrics. Just a little switch. You did the same thing, like 34. She was sort of switch the words around, and it gives it a little bit more texture. If that's what you're saying too. Well, as did we release them?
Okay, so we have a new contributor to the sample. Whose name is Renee Schumberger. She lives in Pullman, Washington. And I came to know her about a month ago because she wrote an email saying that she found the Cenacle online and she'd read it and very much enjoyed it. And it made her happy.
Wow.
So I wrote her back and said, that's very sweet, thank you very much. And she said something about, she really enjoyed the poetry in it, and she said something about dabbling in poetry. And my antenna, my editorial antenna, yeah. The thing I like doing second most to writing is editing, went up. Because anybody who says dabbling, there's something there. I had to find out. But I was patient. We exchanged a few more emails. And finally I said, well, you know, if you dabble, send me something. I'd like to see it. Because I didn't know what I was getting into. I figured I could just be encouraging or who knows. And so she sent. She described herself as kind of a fascinating lady. I think she's in her maybe 60s, 50s, 60s. She currently has a job as a 911 dispatcher at nighttime. So she dispatches ambulances and police cars and fire engines for the 911 in Pullman, Washington. And apparently she lived in the wilderness for some years. And she's originally from Idaho. So she sent me a bunch of poems, and I looked through them, and I found three that I thought would be a good start to sort of welcome her into being. I don't think she's ever been on the printed page before, and I wanted to give her some encouragement. I also like these poems. I thought that they captured something unique in her voice. And she said that since we've been in contact, she's resumed writing more seriously.
Wow, that's great.
That must be encouraging for you.
It's extraordinarily encouraging. That's I love doing that. Because I can't write for her, but if I can encourage her to do it herself and to enjoy it and to manifest in that way, then hell yeah. So, that, as a prelude, here are the three poems that we put to Seneca.
One called Easter Island. A drake barefoot on the beach, tanned shoulders, tropical flowers in my hair, ocean's tongue gently lapping at my feet. Sanctuary from discordant language, this world speaks. I lip-read island's silent sounds and stare as her stones begin to sing. Called 6 weeks. I'm drawn to the garden again to kneel in fertile soil, a penitent. My hands toil, untangle weeds, shelter emerging seedlings, as I should have protected you. Fingers touch concave petals, beg forgiveness of each, seeking their hollows to know the curve of your face. And finally, letter to me. I wanted to tell you that your exit wound collapsed my world and my heart. I wanted to tell you about the vertigo I felt as the gravitational force of you left my solar system. Truth is, it was a much smaller thing than universes and stars. Truth is, I found your gloves, in them the imprint of your hands, and I wept.
That's marvelous.
Never been published.
That's marvelous.
She handwrites her stuff.
That's marvelous.
Isn't that wonderful?
Sure.
Isn't that awesome? She said it all began because they wrote you a fan letter. And I said, famous last words, right? Never tell me that you write, because I will publish you sooner or later.
Well, if it's good.
But yeah, that's, well, yes. But I have a faith that, I have a faith that everyone can write something good. Some of us can write millions of things good, but everybody can write one thing good.
Oh, yeah.
And I will find it. That's my mission.
Yeah, sure. That's great.
Isn't she awesome? Yeah, she's just, it's just, and I asked permission for her poems to be read tonight. I told her that we have a gathering, and she was all thrilled. And she said she started writing seriously, and it's like, wow. Because she sounds like she's lived quite a life. She's been married. She's lived in the wilderness. She's a 911 dispatch. I mean, this is someone who has some stories to tell, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so...
Wow. Quite a find.
Yeah. I have 10 poems in this issue. I'm going to read the first... I'm going to read 4 of them this term. because the last bunch kind of go together. As you guys know, I've been writing my Tangled Gate mythology for about a year and a half now, and I felt in the past 2 months, I mean, I was leading toward finishing it for now, but I really wanted to, I felt I'd build up a mythology that interested me for a long time, and I wanted to bring it to a good conclusion so that I could write other things on the other side. Having had the experience of creating a mythology, but not writing within it anymore, so I could just write other stuff. So anyway, these 10 poems bring this mythology to a conclusion. There's no such thing as things really being over in this world, but for now. I'll preface it by saying that your poem about Daedalus, well, Daedalus is my inspiration for the architect in the Tangled Gate mythology, and the way that the original poems left him, he was given his peace in his tower to not worry about the fate of the world anymore. He'd done his part. Now we find out what that means. Yesterday is everything. To dwell is to leave a trace. Once, twice, breathe, relax. Let history's testament fall to sand. Let the trail of old blood diminish away. Let deepest love cup not contain, and thus learn by release. Breathe, relax. A dream. My brother and I building a wall, a construction in words. Languages old like frail, warm skin. Others newer, glowing with seed, humming, partway back to stars. I pause my work, larving up syllables and stones. Look up, see your laughing face, the many of you I've known, common despair. Once, twice, breathe, relax. Let the stars between dull hours be more to guide. Let our humility sup on every beast and bug and vine and stone and new song we aren't. Let the gorgeous rebel of dream become more the tale we yearn to tell. We begin to travel along this wall, find crevices to hold to as more time passes than aught. Years for days, centuries, we cling to this wall as it drives furiously through history. It's an ugly wall to fast to, colored like old blood, and its path goes jagged and uncertain, loses faith as old things do. My brother won't let me go, the path till I make him do. Let me go. Once, twice, breathe, relax. Let the kind hours explain the world to you. Twining fingers, silver falls of leaves, meals desperate and late and fine. There was an hour when you could have flown, did. I'll keep singing this. When I let go of the wall, I wake to my chamber. I'm alone. Shoulder aches. The brother of my dream is the mutt suddenly at my door. His ragged fur, sloppy tongue, excited breathing in my face. I want to tell us both this story if you'll listen. His tail wags a yes, or maybe he just loves me. Dreaming coming stars. Cease the tide by cursing the moon. Crush the drumheads, men will pound their stones twice harder. Find a woman's fire and she will lay dreaming coming stars. Everyone laughs. The king in good spirits, a fairly calm sea. The island near or soon will be. I pet your shaggy head, my brilliant fool. You enjoy being a dog. Permission to feel everything in a moment. Piss freely. What his crew didn't know was that the king had contacted my brother, Benny, traveler in dreams. You, I think. Or some kind of you. An herb he drank later that night, kind of a poison, but has survived enough a deeper entry into dreamland. Passage. Movement. He bid his brothers good night, and they drank on until very late. His mood gave them hope. You had none till the last meeting with the travelers before setting off. Convinced you'd only find your beloved by dreamways, you promised them a more honored place in your future kingdom. The island would ever welcome travelers for the herb. Now I writhe in my bed, poison drunk in my belly, a cloth stuffed in my mouth so none may hear my cries. I have to survive death, alone, uncomforted, and the door will open. Strange, there are two. I choose the one to dreams this time. You begin to doze, lazy, know this tale, both, either. It was you allowed him his grief, his absolute despair. She saw, finally, understood, that yours was to find the island, find the tangled gate. Yours was to save the world. I shake my head, seeing again mud where I saw my king. I'd served no man till I knew you, none since. Knowing your grief better than you did, why it's so, it carved my heart a groove close by yours. There will be two, you told me that night, when he led us alone, king and his queen, together a last time. Give all to the one who comes to you first by the sea. Having done so, the second will come to you, and you may grow old finally. Kissed him last, his wife. You tire of my tower and want to run. I let you chase through my offices outdoors, my day and night without end, my gift from her. I walk more stiffly than I once did. The architect grows old, too, eventually. But each time you visit, Benny, each time I'm able to form you mutt, at least, when I cannot form a man, I wreck your sacrifice anew. That is you who must keep her till the last. You who salved and broke the king's heart, finally, so he would let go and save the world. Between the night and day. Between the night and day without end that you gifted me, a dusk, a dawn, where I love you still. What leaves last, if leaves at all, are the smaller things, cooler moments when we simply shared space. When you studied the tangled gate through my tower office telescope, you wouldn't breathe. I'd listen from across the shadowy specters of the room, not a breath. You'd move the glass, inch by inch, study the maps, move some more, testing what you saw with what you encountered in dreamland. A sudden connection, now a breath. Knowing it wouldn't be in that spot next time. Knowing it, the gate was like that, still. You left little scent those many years. Any man would have sniffed after you, the king's ripening daughter, but little to compare with girls who vied in your shadow. It's like you disappeared in your departures, remained in more obscure ways. It was your passion to know your own truths that ribbons through me even now. How did I come to know what you were? When were you more than beautiful, lonely, and too intelligent princess to me? Was it before or after I let you escape the island? I had chased across centuries to find a way to save the world, and it was you. I believed you were from another place, had come here, and the world of men aborn. And then I learned my own story, too. I was from that far place, from Amandia, as well. We'd been landed on far ends of the story, yours to grow with the world, find its beauties, mine to review its finale. I love you still. We were both contrived for our tasks, however different. An attraction set along our border to assure we'd find each other. The Eros between us, the sparkling fuel by which we'd know the right world true and know others and move on bloodless otherwise. My mutt won't come near me when my dusky walk emits like this one. Contrivances aren't supposed to love each other. Why do these dusks and dawns disturb me more? What is missing? I love you still. I sit in my office, now, tonight, and I look over to my old telescope, perpetually pointing to the gate, whatever world. I see you there, now, tonight, breathless, studying, studying, and I am breathless too. I was then, and you are so close. I've come the world in its centuries to be in this room with you. Why can't I stand? Why can't I approach you to explain what I know, what I don't, and present myself to your womanly gaze for your womanly assessment and perhaps a shy smile and then get a breath, scented aster. And this is the final one for this round. Scented aster, other beauties. We came from Amandia via deeper dreaming through the red bags. You and I were one man, brother, Benjamin, Benny, compelled from one trunk to two branches, two men. I to the building, what they sneering called architecting of the world of men. Sneering because despair, because too many failed worlds, because only madness builds again and again, same hands, same tools, same materials, and smiling expects a novel result. You were the butt, Benny. The wild card in me extracted to run free. You laughed, You raced us up hills, climbed the tallest trees, led the songs wherever we traveled, and invited to a meal and a fire. Your shoulders strong, your body as broad and dense as mine lanky, divided even between your deep shouts and love of open woods and my retreat to murk and thick books. You didn't know we were twain for purpose, by day, by night, by sun, by moon, by waking, by sleep. We receded from each other slowly, a breath, an untwined finger at a time. Perhaps it began with your discontent with lovers. No matter how she approached, shy, brusque, a girl for the gentle slow taking, or one to bind, or to be bound by leather rags, heated with claws or serrated blade, you fretted and hurried too soon from her. Flaws, always flaws you saw in each girl or woman. The shade of a cheek, the roundness of a breast, the want to be solely, wildly possessed, the growl for you and a dozen other heavy cocked men in their turn. Flaws, always flaws. You dreamed more. We ceased our travels because you liked the strange pale woods we had come. There are other beauties than the ones we've known, you'd say to me often, like a prayer, like a tick. Kept me near, for when you woke, witnessed your half-mumbled visions, convinced there was an inner space shared by all, a perfect world, a dreamland. Did you contrive it yourself? Did it contrive you? I would try to tell you what we were, but you smiled like it didn't matter. I asked you, what other beauties? And you said, come with me, brother, let's make them together forever. And then you were gone. Gone to dreamland, become dreamland. I was alone in your pale woods. I could no more find you while asleep than awake. What did this mean? Our trunk was reft. Eventually I mourned and let you go. I stopped looking for you in my dreams and began shaping tools there to bring back. Building tools. Tools to fix the flaws in the world. A world demure enough to make men want to defend and protect her every breath and bloom. A world growling powerful enough to twist their greed, to conquer and tame. Twist it, crying in their minds, come for me now. Come for me, your miracle world, and its every beauty, and release. Come again, and release. It was near the end of the world when you finally let us meet again. I was come in dreamland to an old memory of our pale woods where I lost you. I was leaving in the morning to travel back the years to the island, tangled gate, find and fix the flaws. Hopeless, a woman's scent in my mind still. Tired, her embrace easy cost to let this next imperfect world go. Came bounding up to me, barking, joyous, wet-tongued, ugly, beautiful mutt, and you, Benny. Barks, licks, pants, what you could give me to hold of you, so I would not ask your help mending the flaws. So if I failed, I did with your love and no more. I held you, hugged you, worried to your glory my long fingernails in your shaggy fur, woke with your scent in my nose, my cheeks drying from your many kisses. I left for the island, the gate, and willing forgot you until later, until I was retired here, day and night forever, and when we met, it was in waking this time. I had nothing left to ask of you. You still came as mutt, and neither of us pressed man from you. Perhaps where my discontent? Perhaps I want you man, not mutt in my arms? Perhaps begin our travels anew, having saved the world, flaws and all, our turn again, together again? You sniff, you bark, you lick, pee and roll happily and shit. I want other beauties than these, brother. Scent of aster in my mind. Your old laughter, too.
So that's those four.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, or more, Joe?
Mm-hmm. I think, maybe.
Just want to understand. Don't think I have the tools. Yeah, I love the style. God knows I love the style, and it's just so identifiably you, you know? It is your voice.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I have yet to really weave together the threads of your mythos. You know, I haven't quite, you know, because you use first person I a lot and in various ways.
Yeah.
You know? That can be confusing. Mm. Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's one poem in here. It might be one of the ones I read where I shift from first to third to second person.
Yeah. And that's you know that's it's challenging. You know.
I don't do it on purpose. It just happens. You know.
Well, it's you know. It's definitely a style, and you know, it's a lovely it's a lovely excursion. You know, I just, you know, it's just in my nature to kind of want to know what's happening. You know? What's happening? You know?
You have a great presentation, Raymond.
Oh, thank you.
Really?
You mean my reading?
Yeah.
You do, yeah. You read
really?
Well. Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah, you know, you obviously know your stuff, yeah.
Well, so what we have thus far is this. I'll give you the nickel summation. In the original Tanglegate poems, the architect aided the princess in choosing to commit to the world. The world was populated by alien beings. They came here from their dying world. They came here through dreamways. And the architect was a figure who helped the princess through her travels to decide that they were looking for a perfect world because they didn't want their race to die again. They wanted to figure out a way so that this time they wouldn't get it wrong. That's always been the underlying theme, is like somehow there's this thought that if we made a certain move, like if we killed Hitler in 39, or if we did this or that, and what the princess learns in the original poems is that that's just not the way things work. History is not numbers and names. History is flesh. And you don't heal flesh backwards, you heal it forwards. So she realizes that there's no perfect world for her people to come to and commit to. There's just a world that they commit to and try to do better. It's not much, it's not a very reassuring message in a way, but it's a message that it's your world, commit to it, do what you can.
Do what you want, yeah.
Yeah. So, at the end of the poems, she grants him his peace, which is to just live in his tower with his books forever. He's granted a kind of an immortality of a sort. To be at peace with his books and his dog. When I revisit that in these poems, I realized he's bored. He's bored. He's just
not enough.
It's not enough. He pursues. I don't describe it, but he pursues into his own. Like, who is he? And he discovers that he's from the other world too. He's not a man. He's not, and that explains to him why he's able to do things that ordinary men can't do. And so he grows restless over time. He learns that his dog is actually his brother, who appears to him in like his brother has somehow over the course of time been lost to dreamland. He just, in my stories, dreamland is literal. It is not figuring out, someone said something mean to you today, you had a dream tonight. I don't do that. I mean, I do think there are dreams like that, because I have them too, but I think there is an element to dreaming that is far more mysterious, and I don't try to explain it, I just play with it because it's fun. So I literalize dreamland and say, dreamland is a place you can travel, if it's a place you can travel in it, you can travel through it, you can work with it, narratively speaking. And so his brother lives in dreamland and manifests as a dog for his own reasons. And these poems are about the architect being restless. He wants his brother as a man that he can put his arms around, not the dog. And he misses the princess. And that's the nickel tour.
Okay. Okay. That's helpful.
Yeah. I don't like...
I'm just sort of wondering. I mean, I've only been here like a couple of years or so. Am I missing... I'll have to go back through my volumes, but I'm just sort of wondering. Because this is also tied in with Labyrinthine.
Yeah, Labyrinthine, they became more tied in.
Yeah.
It used to be that I just wrote poems and then I'd take lines from the poems and put them in labyrinthine as an experiment. Yeah. I like the idea, like you were talking about, taking your sunrise poem and turning it into prose. I love the idea of developing a voice that just works for whatever the hell it is you want to do it with. If you choose to be poetry, it's poetry. If you choose to be prose, like, I don't differentiate anymore. I just want a voice that just, a switch hitter. But not even switch hitting, just like omni hitting. I just want a voice that just does it all, that's capable of doing it all, whatever I needed to do. So what I would do is I would write poems and I would mix them into labyrinthine to see what would happen. In recent years, the Tangled Gate myth, what I've essentially done is I'm telling the same myth two ways. I'm telling the fictional version of it, and I'm telling the poetic version of it. Because I like the idea of myth where you're not bound to a single truth. So you just keep coming up with it. I also like the idea of evolving narrative, where you come up with new ideas, you introduce them, and they affect everything. They're on. It's experimental, and it's hard to understand, and I don't pretend to understand it all myself, but it's how I play.
Yeah, well,
I keep myself interested in writing.
Certainly worth exploring. That's for darn sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if some of it doesn't, if some of it is wiggy, I agree.
I tell you, I find myself so inadequate, and I keep saying to myself, "Tom, you're just a bum who tells tales."
You tell some damn good tales.
That's it.
No, we're pure.
Well, there's the literal, there's the linear tale. You know, there's the linear tale, and then there's the oblique, the more oblique kind of tale, I would imagine. There's probably all different kinds of ways of telling it. I think Ray's telling a tale, you're telling a tale, but they're different styles. You know, there's different layers, you know. But I'm with you. You know, I mean, I feel inadequate, you know, and really, boom.
No, you guys are peers.
Plumbing it.
You guys are peers. You guys are totally, totally peers. And yeah, there's no higher or lower here. There's just, you know, fraternity. That's always the way I see it. And it's your turn.
So it's my turn. Okay. I forgot to bring. I was going to bring a copy of you know, the Van Gogh painting, Starry Night.
Yeah.
Starry Night. I have a nice print of Van Gogh's Starry Night. I was going to bring that because the title of this particular poem is Starry Night. I'll read this poem first. Each time I get the blues, I put on wooden shoes. Then I eat Gouda cheese. I love that cheese so much. I wish I'd been born Dutch. Dutch cleanser scours sinks best, and all the Dutch are blessed with art ability, painters, Hals, Rembrandt. I'd be Dutch, but I can't. They still make Dutch boy paint. Vermeer was Dutch. I ain't. The Dutch trade sailed the sea. Some couples date Dutch treat. The Dutch men beat their meat. If I am in a jam, I dream of Amsterdam. The Zuider Zee will freeze. Most Dutch girls can ice skate. I sometimes masturbate. My beer is Amstel Light. Guys masturbate, all right? Forget I said that, please. Dutch kids play Dutch goose. Regarding self-abuse, Stuyvesant Dutch through and through. No doubt did it too. And the men in Dutch colonies and Henry Hudson and crew. I think all Dutch men still do. I don't do it a lot. In fact, I'd rather not. Windmills turn in the breeze. Bees spread tulip pollen. Tulips come from Holland. It's called the Netherlands. some Dutch use both hands. Myself, I'd rather squeeze a duchess really tight. Van Gogh's Starry Night is a Dutch masterpiece. The Dutch don't live in Greece. Speaking of Chinese, the Dutch are pacifist. One time I sprained my wrist as I pleasured myself. Dutch porcelain is Delft. The Dutch are Portuguese. And very good at banking, building dikes and yanking. Crank when they're alone. Van Gogh was quite well known for eccentricity.
Oh my gosh, that is plastic. That's fucking awesome.
That's one of the weirdest ones.
Is that really classic? Is that recent?
Classic.
Just strange one, I must admit. Yeah, that's pretty recent.
Oh, thank goodness. I thought you weren't writing funny poems.
That's pretty, well, that's pretty recent. Yeah.
That's
all right, you like the funny ones?
No, I'm just saying. I like both. I worried for the fate of the funny ones.
All right, well, I'll give you another one. This one isn't too long either. This is Plautus translated. Plautus was a comic Roman poet. Plautus translated. Unwe aitne feeling horny hay, I to my earl gay entre ed say, east play igelte my limpinky day, she to is they, alvi lay alvie, go astivate may earth say, oi vey, highway aitne I did, estingue, because you're an epicre, ellie smeig pay. I pulled up my outer tray, if you say, stuck with a pair of uble alfe. She is an ishes they cruel aunt kay. Hot way akke, east hay, itch bay. I guess I'm ely ray, ruly tay, akke.
Where the hell does it come from?
Why whisper, said the comet, gently floating, drifting, down, down, down. Brightly like an open doorway on a cold night in December, bringing warmth of get-together. It softly nestled, comfortable, and with a feather's impact, lightly left a scar of gratitude. We met in fortunate collision. Your glistening trajectory, blazing, golden, tenderly, descended in a muted hush, brushing jewel dust while exploding onto my glad consciousness. Meeting you reminded me how long I've been away from home. Enjoying you is coming back to celebrate a holiday. That's just a very simple poem. Yeah, it's a, you know, kind of a simple poem, you know.
Well, it's lovely.
And then this is the last one I'll read this turn around. This is how it turned out. And I just don't think I'm going to mess with this much more, because it just drove me crazy. You're yesterday's river. And to think I was immersed in you, swam in you, got carried away by you, nearly drowned in you, never feeling so alive. You aren't that deep, river. You're less refreshing now. I've had my drink. You don't seem cool anymore, river. You're self-absorbed. What appeared shiny below your surface turned out to be sparkling superficialities. You're transparently shallow, river. There's not much to you after all. Don't expect me to bend and lap at your edge, or kneel, supplicant, cupping my hands with small sips of your spare time, now that you have places to go, people to see, and so many things to do. I'm not that thirsty, river. I'm over you. Run along, river.
Nice.
That's my turn. Thank you for giving me my turn.
This is a revision five times on top of an old poem. And it's called Child in the Deep Well. With long iron we pulled her body free, pale dress twisted by an unearthly god. All of her further illness, little sea eyes hammered shut, hair a tangled sword. Night child caught in one broad and sweep, silver trod her shapely face. Sparkle shone where faint stars glowed, the angle steeper into deep wells narrow, mouth of stone. Parents, more silent than morning's drift of darkness, stare through wells of late turmoil, her death stepped forward, downward shipped, escape from earthly joys to earthly soil. Water smolt takes away what's gone cold, leaks through mad scars of her dread eye and throat where escapes from leaky fold, her long breath loose, least of bosom supply. Here at times she ladled worn pewter cup, cooled her lips with moment of deep rock, roots shifting underground, earth stirred up from this rocky throat, mere raindrops mock. Low wonder, secret stars have fallen there, passing softly through the bucket's grip, where seven sisters brave cluster bare, no shyer her, hardened on one last trip into that low field, freed by lengthy bars, wandering child, we raked up from stars.
Ooh.
Nice.
Ooh.
You happy with it now?
I don't know. I really don't know. But it's one of those things I'll think about on the way home. With slight attention.
That's a funny, yeah, I had a friend of mine, I did a series of murals up in Lowell for an eccentric fellow, and he had asked me as I was painting one of his murals, he says, how do you know when it's done? You know? And I just had to answer, I don't know how I know when it's done.
It might be simply walking away, and it may be that. And when you say hurrah, sometimes you're wrong. And I've done that too. So, I did it! And look at a day later and say, oh, geez.
I bet that doesn't happen to you too often.
It does.
Well, I have two poems by Tom Robbins that I found.
Poems by Tom Robbins?
Yeah. Have you read Tom Robbins?
Tom Robbins. What has he written?
He wrote Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, that he made a movie out of, and then Still Life with Woodpecker was probably one of his more famous ones.
Mm. Yeah. So that's why the name is familiar to me then, yeah. Cowboys Get the Blues. But I have not read that, no.
He's very funny. He's very clever, very philosophical.
He's like Kurt Vonnegut.
Okay.
He's from Washington, so he has the Northwest sort of mindset.
Yeah.
But anyway, I randomly came across a couple of poems of his. I have three, but I think I'll only read two. So, the first one is called Creole Debutante. She went to the school of Miss Crocodile, learned to walk backwards, skin a black cat with her teeth. Soon she could dance with dead pirates, cook perfect gumbo, telephone the moon Colette. But it took 23 doctors to fix her after she kissed that snake.
Oh, that's a good one. I didn't know that was the ending. Wow.
This one's called Triplets. I went to Satan's house. His mailbox was painted black. A fleet of bone crushers was parked in his driveway. The thorns on his rose bushes were longer than shoots, and 66 roosters scratched in his front yard, their spurs smoldering like cheap cigars. I went to Satan's house. It was supposed to be an Amway party. I wanted one of those hard-as-hell steak knives. The ones that can't tell the difference between Mama's sponge cake and a chunk of rock cocaine. I went to Satan's house. I felt a little out of place. But Satan's twin daughters soon put me at ease. They tried on funny hats for me, showed me jewels, danced around my chair. They read my fortune in a bowl of ashes, let me pet their Dobermans, and watch while they rinsed out their pink underthings. I stopped by Satan's house. I just happened to be in the neighborhood. Satan came downstairs in a Raiders jacket. His aura was like burnt rubber, but his grin could paint a sunrise on a coal shed wall. I see you've met desire and fulfillment, he said, polishing his monocle with a blood-flecked rag. Regret is in the kitchen making coffee.
So now, we are going to travel the last six poems of the Tangled Gate for now. Okay, here we go. Deeper Creature Time, 1. Deeper Creature Time, he writes, finding his old notes ledger and resuming a fresh page. Looking for a gape in my world, I keep thinking about this, about how little I know about it. They weren't from Amandia as we were. They were native to this world, the island, its white woods, endless, pathless white woods. Pauses. Looks around the nearly ageless dank of his office, its books piled high, containers of herbs and potions, trinkets from the many places and times he'd traveled, smells of decay dried to dust. His desk, really a great table, covered too, but for the area before him, cleared away periodically. Himself dressed in soft rags, no one to show for, shine for, bother about. His body nearly immortal, but old with patina, time and sadness. Resumes, struggles, or maybe it should be called deeper creature timelessness, for they do not live with awareness of time, shackled to its passing and finitude. For them there is no time. Nods. Theirs is an existence outside time's passing, like my own, but that they aren't even aware of time. I am. I am made by hands, yet I am a man. Picks up his ledger and on a whim brings it to the tower office's front window, near to his great spyglass and thick maps of the Tangled Gate, where she'd sat. He sniffs, can't help himself, just memories. Table not a quarter the size of his own, he moves things around, settles in, dust displaced, stays displaced, awake again, wondering. And there below, the gate, this still the island, and that yet the gate? He mulls. This discontent won't solve itself, nor will sitting in this office do any better. The gate? Nothing to lose but his loneliness. Stands, looks around, finds his long, unworn overcoat, feels odd, like he won't be back here for a long while. Like it's time. For me, there is time, at least for now. Deeper Creature Time, 2. The gate never changes. So massively tall in its legend where its scrollwork peaks for those lost. I enter and there's the fountain, perpetually crumbling, yet ever gushing, insisting a drink. A drink and a choice. I briefly consider declining, but realize I need the gate's help. Whatever that might be, I need it. So I take my two-handed scoop of the cold, tingling water, music to taste, water to listen to, drink it down deep, and move past the fountain. They knew me once. We became friends and together helped the princess succeed. How do I reach them now? Remember my old advice to her. Tap my head once, my heart once, sniff twice, and begin to follow somewhat seeming random paths of vines and stones. Sky above a murky gray. My breath slows nicely. I feel my body in a less heavy way. But eventually I slow, frustrated. It is possible to fail and exit the gate of failure? Why this quick to quit in me? Come on, come on, I begin to call, wordlessly. Call and call. I cry and howl, moan under, summon all the hope and hopeful purpose I have. Come on, come on! Softly at first, then again a little louder, something echoes through the air and through my mind. A cackle, another, swooping and swirling around me. Ringing, echoing, echoing, then echoing the echoes. It cannot but be my old friend the wee imp, Can it be? It must. Deeper creature time three. The cackles continue their echoing play, and I follow, and yet no closer. I must faster. I must play. I think of old times, the white bunny, and I try. Long ears, glowing fur, pink nose, nothing. Nothing. Still man-shaped. Man-shaped. Not thinking at all, this is my body's turn to do. I sleep down, not quite a bunny or an imp, but a creaturely form all my own. What it might have been, I now am, for this little while. Listen close, I speed. The cackles triple with delight. This is their architect come to play. They direct me, a long tunnel of dancing cackles, and I follow. I speed like no man has. Man I am, man I'm not. Speed till I slow. Slow sudden to stop. A cave. This cave. I know it. The beast long lived here. The cackles are urging me on in, but I remain still. The beast is a force is deeper than my knowledge or skill. The beast is this world itself, given a body to roam it, a mind to wreck itself and all dwelling on it. I kneel very low toward the cave and its possible inhabitant. I speak quietly, scrub a man's natural arrogance before his world, his hands and eyes and minds and throat's raw power, and I speak for my long loneliness and yearning. My friend brought me here. She urges me to pass. She is a creature and travels to her home. I'm a man of a kind and wish to visit with my questions. I ask your leave for passage. Perhaps there is still good in me to do others. Upon my last words, and only these, a breath, a stirring, the sounds of something unearthed from dug and tossed rock, something emits the cave. I stand, approach. No, yes, tis. The blue bag I gave the princess long ago, whole and handled still. The cave says nothing more, but I sniff twice and feel my entry aloud. Realize myself still in creaturely form as I make to pick up the bag with swift but clumsy paws. Regret, but reform. About to revisit its contents, curious what remains, but the cackles suddenly everywhere, high and low. They practically push me into the cave, carrying my old bag unopened for now. Well, then again, I move at my own swift speed now. I feel more myself as this latter-day adventure continues, uncertain but verbaling, thinking me ready for anything. No, and not. I come of a sudden into the too bright central cavern of these caves and tunnels, and for a lingering moment as I stop, crouch, choke my breath and beat still, I hear the scraping stones, bare feet upon stones, bare feet dancing, dancing, a life body conjuring songs from patterns and dreams. My heart stops. I fall away. Deeper creature time four. When I come to, I am aloft, but back in the tunnel I emerged from. My form changed to, ah, I am again hummingbird like when I first met her along paths of the gate. I'm afraid. She dances happily with the creatures. She's found her content. She gifted me my tower, day and night without ending, and I balked, dissatisfied with retiring quietly to a drawer, a man-shaped tool plied and done. I flit some more, find myself falling into these pleasures. Remember to listen with ears, and there are still cackles around me, waiting, now nudging a little. Come along, hummingbird, new play, new play. Enter the great cavern again, and nerd to its bright light now, and see the princess has concluded her solitary dance, and now every creature, big and small, joins in her frolic. Many of the major bears in this number, little ones too, even wee ones, and their oddest of noises make me think of the imp somehow. Several giraffes, a great hedgehog, the white bunny, so many more. I join. Before I can think to think or choose to choose, I join in and dance. Flitter high and low, feel out the song they sing. Find my voice among the many others and join in too, like I belong. I belong. My form shifts, unknown to me, slowly. I become less hummingbird and more the creaturely form I chose to chase the cackles, swift and sleek, but then less this than a man's form, my form, still dancing, still singing, still smiling among these old friends. When the scene crescendos to its slow close, I feel crowds of creatures dividing in twain before me. As I half-intentioned, nudged and nudged by cackles, by click-clicks and noises too now, I arrive, fully formed man, the dance and song finished. I arrive to the shocked, smiling, beautiful face of my long-beloved princess, oh mine. Deeper creature time. it's actually not called Five, the fifth one. Grand production begins with an epigraph from Heraclitus. We are and are not. Your smile holds me from falling, keeps me from fleeing. Your hair is red as always, is long. Your eyes still a fairy blue, but nothing to your smile as you slow me enough to rest, not pause in my place. Your smile the sum of what all these years have not been. Your smile sucks upon me until I am well chewed, swallowed, expelled back to myself as this calm reunion's moment. You came. You called? She nods, steps forward, and grasps my hand. It was time. I feel something wordless, something I do not know. Good or bad, I don't know. Look down. Our hands, as they keep grasping, meld to one. I gasp, begin to laugh. Still holding her, our hand, I lean over and laugh loud. What is it? I hold up our hand. This. I think this is what got lost along the way. We let go each other's hand and then came history. All of it. She nods. I please her. She leads me by our hand somewhere. Woods, white woods. No creatures follow us. All is quiet. I want to say and say and say. I do too. It's okay. Calm. A beat. A breath. Okay. Where are we going? Where I was bound already. I waited for you. We come through the woods to a clearing, a long one. And I see at the far end a platform, atop which sits a grand stage. The princess smiles even more so at me. I feel as though our limbs are twining amongst each other in her excitement. Ah, many creatures now join us in the clearing. We have no special place to stand or sit amongst our friends here, although I notice the white bunny, the turtle who is not a turtle, and yes, the crazy conniving imp, all nuzzle up near to us. They know me, sniff twice familiarly. My heart shines and falls free. 'Tis a grand production. I nod, there is no time. She laughs, points. A white-furred bear wearing a long Scotch-styled scarf is waving a long paw and crying, "On with the show!" There is a deep black bear who comes out to dance, tells a few jokes, juggles a few, then more, then countless balls, then executes an impossible tumble into the crowd, returning before he left. There's the black and white bear who slides onto the stage, dancing high and low, tapping his paws artfully to music. I wonder must be the traveling troubadours, and brings out the black bear and others to leap and fall to the audience's delight. Our friend the white bunny on stage performs many dazzling long-eared hops, impossibly high and fast. There is a comical Dalmatian and his daffy quips. There is a purple-furred dancing creature, long ribbons in dizzying flourish. There is the tumbling brown monkey who jumps seeming miles high. Many, many others come and go. I forget who I am and am smiling the princess's smile, laughing her laugh, feeling her long deep warmth with these friends. This is who I am when the world isn't in peril, or when we let each other be. There's the handsome bumblebee gliding over us, and atop his furred back is a small melancholy faced pup, and they fly together not like steed and rider, but like their paws two are one, like there is no other way to be. Stars above, earth below, we two are one, we two are one. I wake. Cry out. Shh. Look around. Oh, creature's cavern. They are clustered all around us, still dozing. She smiles down at me. I panic, but feel her hands still warmly won. Relax a moment. Let her arms around me possess me all. So close. Release. So close. Yes and no. We recede a little, just a little. There's more. There's else. Not every creature lives safely here, nor most of the world. Shaped like men, creatures, trees, everything. It's why I called you, why you brought my blue bag. I nod. I'm ready. This is the last poem in the Tangled Leaf series for now. And it's called, very deliberately, Deeper Creature Time Leading Off. It begins with the epigraph, "Nothing Remains Still," from Heraclitus. Sitting side by side, we unclasp the blue bag and open its cover. A soft floral scarf covers its contents. She removes a dearly known item to me, the braided threads, hands them to me. These are still powerful for our task. I nod. Then she takes out two small red balls, blue-striped, three more orange these. She nods this time. I put them aside me with the braided thread. The creatures stir and wake around us, sniff twice, no change, and gather close. We each touch the creature near to hand, the princess or white tiger, me, his kind-eyed bullfrog companion. I feel each creature touching to each, one to many to all. Paws, nuzzles, we two are one, we two are one. You're doing this to teach me. You know this already, you always did. The princess smiles at me, her smile like shine, like wash, lets me close to her. Her skin, her hair, allows me rove across her cheek, touch her lips, smooth to her neck, cross her shoulders, upon her breasts, of them, in them, on them, pleases me man, pleases me soul, becomes my tongue, sliding across her body. Taste you tasting me, let flesh meld in light, let flesh twain and delight to chase, release, we two are one and two and one and two and one, two. She lays the colored balls, the creatures know them as treasures, in a pattern to broadcast us where we will. Twine one to another, the princess allowing the girls form in her for my pleasure, touched by every creature as they doze near us, and later to dancing, and later to exploring cavern and gate above alike, we begin to sing pathways into the world, touch and teach others how. Remember some things. It took thick books of why and walls of fear against beasts of the world and unknown men's faces to shock you into following, obeying silence. It took centuries of contrived sufferings to convince you that this world is to be suffered. It took great iron cities built, gouging and burning from the earth to convince you that the world does not easily provide to all. Caterwauling leaders to scare you from each other too close and let the suffering men and women in the streets lie and let them suffer. You had to tame. You had to conquer. You had to cage. You had to own. You had to celebrate dominance with feast. Cry and fuck. Cry and fuck some more. There is no time, especially in dreams. As we sing into the world, a low you will not yet hear. 'Tis because it began in your dreams. What we sang you as we held you close, traveled you by cosmos and microbe to see in all we two are one, we two are one. Travel you to the tangled gate, source of your world, secret you can enter and learn to know, just to drink from the fountain, still lingering on the gate's legend for those lost. Yes, you were. You'll find your way now. In the gate, down as many tall pathways of vines and stones, we'll follow you now. There is the hummingbird and its tale of men and women remembering their first song and flying away, awakening and flying away. Perhaps you will lead to Cloverdale, its dank first room, its room of mirrors, its desert, and there a shack. Will you meet the small exotic or the tramp, his grieving friend? Where will you lead us next? Maybe, freely going now, you will find the hex stick in your hands and thus decide easily where this dream next. Lead us on or let us go. Part the gate itself or else a smile and deeper in. If Cloverdale, you might come to the carnival room, if you can. Learn to sing how, and entering its marbles, for you a long-limbed fiddler, for you a great buck barking you to knee. Will you carriage with us to the far end of the world, behold the sleepers? Join them a while in their sleeping capsules, drink the juice to cross the dreaming, or show them how without capsule, without juice. Will you choose to travel with us, many dreams like these? Learn what we are, architect and princess, and behold the island outside the gate. Live with us its story, how we came to be, what we learned to know, what mysteries we cannot wreck, wild cards to our equations, our songs, our histories, our loves. As we sit here with you now, in this warm cavern, these friendly creatures all around, some dozing, all partners in the we invite you to wake when you will, how you will. Make of this dream and its like whatever you wish, but return whenever you wish to as well. The braided thread we leave, ever weaving through your dreams, yours to grasp or lie. And when she at last came and took your other hand, and he came and took my other, something was now complete, now told of what was and what passes on to be. I did not let go. I am a man, and I both hope and fear. But I willed my heart open wider to all, to every and all. We two are one. We two are one. Together we will architect this world. Together we will architect this beautiful world.
It's a pretty ending. It's a very hopeful ending.
Yeah.
So you're done for now with them.
Yes. That finished finished that 3 weeks ago.
I think it would be difficult to comment on the style of the form. I think only, by my dim lights, the only comment would have to do with content and meaning as opposed to style and structure, you know.
Well, when I write, I really don't know. I don't have a. I don't go into it knowing what I'm going to do. With these poems, I was driving on a narrative, so I had some ideas that I was working with that each poem had to further the narrative, and I wanted to conclude.
Unbelievable.
But I wasn't sure how I was going to get there.
Unbelievable.
The last one I wrote here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, the last one I was I was having so much fun with that last one. I'm sure you've had this experience too, when you just know you're writing something good and you're enjoying writing it. You're like aware of the fact that you're writing something good and you're delighted in the actual moment of creation. I was having that experience with this last poem, like, I'm bringing this series to a close for now, and I'm bringing it to a close for now good. I'm doing right by it. I'm making it so that whenever and however, whatever my future relation of my writing to this finite series of poems, I left it in a good place. I left it firing on all cylinders. It's like a TV show that ends on a really great episode. You know, they don't go on 3 years too long. Just, it's like they go out with all blazes going. And that's how I felt. I was sitting at the table upstairs and writing, and I was like, I was practically having a fit. I was like laughing and making noises, and Cassie wondered if I was like breaking down for good finally. But I felt it. It's like, yes, that's exactly the way this ends. It ends with the architect and the princess together in the creature cavern, and she's holding the hand of the demon, who's her sister, and he's holding the hand of Benny, who is finally a person, not a dog, at least for the moment. And they are traveling through people's dreams, telling them the story of the Tangled Gate. They're telling them this whole story about the origin of their world and how it came to be and what they're trying to do, which is to heal it. And inviting them along, but not forcing them to believe any of it, because you wake up, oh, it was just a dream. But, maybe not. The invitation remains completely open, and if you want to know whether or not it's a dream, just look in your dreams for the braided thread. Pick up the thread, and I don't actually know what happens when you pick up the braided thread, but the braided thread is like, they say with lucid dreaming, you should look for cues. One is, light switches don't work. Another is, it's hard to read language on page. There's like these, I don't know whether they work or not, but so the braided thread is their clue that if the dreamer of the dream wants to test the dream for more than just randomness, pick up the braided thread. There, it's your signal. And that's it. There was a moment, Joe, where in that last poem where I realized that if I was not careful, the princess and the architect would become like those like people knocking on the door with the good news. You know? Because they got the way and the truth, and I thought, no. And I panicked in mid-poem. Like, there's a part of me, like, in mid, like, no, I can't have them doing that. There's, like, I too much believe in free will on, like, every... I don't believe in free will completely, because I think that as physical bodies, there's limitations to us.
There are some determinants. Yeah.
But I do believe that forward is free will. Like, backward is not free will, but forward is free will. As much as there is free will. And so I compelled the poem to actually like go in that direction.
Respect it. Respect free will, yeah.
Like, they've got to have the choice.
Through yourself.
You know, because oftentimes with revelatory dreams, they don't really give you an option. They're like, well, here's Joseph in the many-colored goat, and then, you know, you're an idiot if you don't, like, follow through.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make it so that it was always the dreamer's choice. Because I think in the end, I was just thinking about, thinking about it now, I was probably simply projecting, if I was them in that situation, I would figure to myself that I wouldn't want anybody joining and trying to save the world who felt like weirdly compelled. I'd want people to join because they consciously chose, not because they were come upon a vision and they're forced to.
They're also on a voyage of self-discovery.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, they picked up the thread by their own...
As opposed to already convinced that this right. is the way. Yeah.
Right. I wanted it to be...
that much.
I wanted it to be a choice, and also a humble choice. A choice given and taken humbly. Seemed important.
I can relate to that.
So
I think that's a good... That's probably a good way. And I think you ended it up in respect... to that mindset, you know. I think it conveys that mindset really, really nicely. You know, there isn't an arbitrary path, no. You know. There's a thread. There may be more than one, you know. It winds and...
Well, the princess wanted to... I mean, the prince... They want to do right, and we have people through history who want to do right. And there's different ways of doing it. I mean, there's... the way that I don't like is the way in which someone comes at me and says they have the answer.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
But
well, that's.
But I think with the princess and architect, it's like what they don't have is they don't have the answer, but what they do have is they have the story. They have the story that they've experienced of what they believe is going on and what they believe is to come, and it's no more or less than what they have. You know,
and they are only one pair, and they could only be but one pair among many pairs.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, I was playing with wanting to say something definitive, and but crisscrossing it with not wanting to have the characters sound fanatical, because they're not fanatical. It's like at the end, they've been so humbled by the facts of the lives that they've experienced that they haven't come through sure. They've just come through with love. That's all. That's all they come through with.
That's enough.
And with the sense that...
that's enough.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A sense that love and fraternity. And... because, like, I didn't know what to do with the architect. And then I thought, no, he's lonely. I mean, he saved the world, and he wants to... he doesn't want to retire. He wants to continue to do good, but he doesn't have any clue how. And so he has to find his way. And I'd left the princess at the end of those original poems. She'd saved the world, and that was kind of where it ended. And then I thought, okay, now you've saved the world, now the work begins. Now that you've committed to this world, you know. It's sort of like when people are young and they move around a lot, some people like travel from town to town, they're like rootless. Eventually they commit to one and they realize that it's probably no more better or worse than any other of them.
Yeah.
It's just the one they've chosen.
Yeah.
And then the work of what that means.
What the job was.
Right, exactly. It, like anything that involves an ongoing commitment in life is something where the work begins with the commitment.
Yeah. All right, so this one's called Thoughtful. And then it moves right along. He searched around for the perfect gift to give to his best and only friend on his birthday. He'd know he was thinking of him, but he didn't have much to spend. He considered a book since he likes to read, or something more personal he might need, a pullover sweater or sweater vest, so he could go places appearing well-dressed. In shops and stores with crowded aisles and decisive he hunted meandering, there were so many options from which to choose, then at last he discovered the ideal thing. A box at home would fit just right. He rolled it in tissue and placed it inside. He folded the box. He taped the box tight. The wrapping paper he used was white. He tied it with ribbon, then finally inscribed the gift card, quote, "This is for me." When he looked at his one gift, he felt excited. When he opened the gift, he was simply delighted. I read it too fast?
No, perfect.
All right.
That's funny. Is that funny? I don't even know if it's funny.
Not funny.
It's not funny. Not it funny. Is kind of funny, though.
He's his only friend.
He's his only friend.
And he's out, and he's buying a birthday present for himself.
And it's sad and it's not sad. It's yeah. funny. Yeah. That's funny sadness.
Yeah. There's a word for funny sadness, I suppose. But anyway, okay, so that's fine. Enough of that one.
No, really. Stop. You wanted more? Let's give you more.
All right.
Okay, it rolls along.
Yeah.
Without looking at it on the page, I'm assuming that it's just kind of, there's no games on, there's just line after line.
Yeah, pretty, yeah.
And so you're just reading along.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, who is this friend? That's what I was thinking.
Good.
I was thinking.
Good.
And I'm thinking, well, you know, Joe Coleman, this could be any kind of friend imaginable. It could be a friend, not a friend, no friend, imaginary friend.
I think I could have read it differently. I think I could have had, I think I blew one of the last lines. The
yeah.
wrapping paper he used was white. He tied it with ribbon, then finally inscribed a gift card, quote, "This is for me."
Oh, see, I think I thought you said this is from me.
Yeah.
And then the last line.
I think I blew that line. Yeah.
I don't know if you blew it.
This is for me. Yeah.
But even then, he bought himself a gift.
Bought himself a gift. So nobody else was going to.
Yes, but there's something funky about that. Like if a person has no friends, and then goes to this real extent of buying, like going over all the stores, and then he has a box at home. There's just all sorts of weird, funky stuff going on.
I like
that. That's not simple.
Yeah, no, it's not simple. It's just lonely. It's just as lonely as hell.
It's lonely, but it's not just, it's not pathetic. It's interesting.
Poignant.
It's strange. Why does he have no friends?
Poignant. We don't need to know
it's
that.
It's poignant. There you go.
Yes.
Poignant. What
poignant.
Is point? Poignant is drama plus comedy.
Yeah.
Poignant is drama where you care.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Drama, yeah, well, point
there's out. There's endearing, there's an endearing.
You care, yeah. I don't agree that it's drama plus comedy.
But
I think it's drama where you care.
Drama where you care.
Yeah.
Is poignant.
Yeah.
And a little bit sad.
Yeah, and there's a little mystery to it, too, because you don't know why he doesn't have any friends, you know. Maybe he doesn't have any friends because he's so self-absorbed. Maybe because he only thinks of himself.
Exactly.
You know, who
exactly.
knows? But I don't need to know. It's still lonely. He doesn't have any friends, and you're not going to get any gift unless he gives it to himself.
So he goes to such an extent for that.
He goes to an unknown. Well, because he thinks he's worth it. He thinks he's worth it.
Well, I mean, isn't it funny, though?
No.
It is funny.
No.
He's not a real guy. He's not a real guy.
He might be.
In the poem, he's not a real guy.
He might be.
He might be.
He is now. I've written the poem.
I mean, he's a real guy in the poem, but I mean, he's not like someone that, you know, you have to worry about him putting the gun to his head or something. It's like his
True.
Story is done.
True.
Unless you write another poem where he puts a gun to his head.
What? The gift could have been a gun.
It could have been. That's true.
The gift could have been a gun.
That's true.
Never thought of that.
See?
Oh, maybe I haven't finished.
Maybe he's not done.
Yeah.
What is that box shape like?
Big bottle 33.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, this next one is gentrification. This one is, we won't call it poignant. We'll call this Rye. W-R-Y. Make way for the clean police. They sanitize our society. They clear city streets of panhandling poor. They sweep the homeless into the sea. Step to your left for the wrecking ball. Tenement housing is coming down. They'll bring in a better demography with class to the dark side of town. Move aside, here come the arrivists. No more wrong side of the tracks. The clean police will secure this block for those who pay less income tax than blue-collar 9-to-5 laborers and schmucks who work 3 jobs. Make way, one red line changes it all. Here come the yuppie snobs. That one was quick. That one's pretty recent.
That wasn't right.
Huh?
That was angry.
That's kind of an angry one. That's kind of an angry one.
I can think of some political websites that I like that would like a poem like that.
Yeah.
the unlived presence yet to be constructed to. You'll find your fans in the internet. I'll be writing.
This one's called Dignity.
Okay.
This one I wrote as a direct response to what I thought was a veiled criticism of something that I read once. So I have found sometimes that the best thing, you know, one of the best ways for me to handle feelings is to try to write through my feelings, you know, because I'm not much of a one for confrontation. So, you know, if I can write through my feelings, you know. So this was one of the ways I wrote through my feelings after feeling I had been criticized inexcusably. And it's sarcastic, I suppose would be the word, but anyway, it's called Dignity. There is no excuse for being offensive, thoughtless, ill-mannered, sarcastic, or rude. There is no excuse for being distasteful, vulgar, obscene, suggestive, or lewd. There is no excuse for a lowbrow, immature, crass, and abrasive attitude. No excuse for gutter-mouthed crudity, swearing, blue language for... Okay, I'm screwed. Since I've got no dignity, modesty, values, self-respect, style, or class, I'm an ignorant, churlish, deluded, raw, juvenile, obsessive, compulsive dumbass. That's why nobody likes me and I'm a pariah, and nobody talks to me here or at work. They won't sit next to me. They won't be friendly. I'd be bothered by this if I wasn't a jerk.
What was that called again?
Huh?
Dignity?
It's called Dignity.
Oh, that's
right. Yeah. This one's called Together. And this is not a... I just figure if... I have some things in here that are so short I can almost imagine seeing two or three of them on the same page distinctively, you know, so that a short one doesn't have to occupy its own page.
Sure.
This is called Together. Listen, I said to her, I really love you. I don't want to lose you. I think we should get a double lateral pelvic fusion, a surgical procedure attaching us together at the hips. I'll buy you a brown paper bag which you can wear over your head when you want a little privacy. This was a bold suggestion on a first date.
Awesome. That was fantastic.
Thank you so much.
That was just...
This one's a little more lengthy. I don't know if I read this at the Beebe School. I doubt that I did. My vegetable past, farmer's market.
Possibly. I remember something about vegetables in the
satanic vegetable, satanic vegetable cult.
You might have read it for Halloween.
No, it's not that old.
No?
No.
I don't know. I remember something about vegetables, but give it a shot.
Near the end of my college education, I got into veggie experimentation.
Yes. Good. Read it. It's great.
I've done a little editing on it.
Okay.
Near the end of my college education, I got into veggie experimentation. Regrettably, as a related result, I joined the vegetable Satanist cult and underwent horrid humiliation to pass through this secret initiation. The sadistic vegetable Satanists tied string beans and pea pods around my wrists. I was told to sit in the corner, shut up, and drink carrot juice from a plasticine cup. Then they took off my jacket and one of my shoes and forced me to read agricultural news. But just by the hairs on my chinny-chin-chin, I survived the ordeal. The cult voted me in. They gave me my vegetable Satanist name, and from that moment onward, Joe Coleman became the satanic, majestic, infernal, dark lord of the wicked zucchini, anathema gourd, and nasty, annoying, demonically evil cabbage infested with root worm and weevil. His royal red radish, deriving all power from the double-horned, cloven-hoofed cauliflower, and deputy sheriff of bottomless pit filled with fire and brimstone, hot peppers and shit, the devilish pitchfork-wielding bane of butternut, squash, and cucumber stain. The garlic breath, turnip head minion, Joe. It's a long honorific. It's stupid, I know. Then the blasphemous mark of the beat was applied. I was manicured, pedicured, plain terrified. They might restyle my hair or trim down my beard. I'm grateful they didn't. That would have been weird. I took part in rituals that filled me with shame. These all involved produce. The leeks were to blame. Like offering our souls to the great Brussels sprout and crowning a candied yam, dancing about the enthroned potato or bending the knee at the altar of cream cheese on celery or the communal baking of fresh pumpkin pie. I watched innocent organic vegetables die. At 2 a.m. once, we all walked to a farm, and after disabling the rooster alarm, we kidnapped some onions and young ears of corn and filmed videos of sick vegetable porn. Rough, lurid, three-way onion action. Corn ears getting audio satisfaction. Corn kernelingus. Raw onion kink. Cream of corn, onion skin. Worse than you'd think. Then we slaughtered the onions in sacrifice. We sliced them and cooked them up with some white rice. And we ate them! While chanting, Uncle Ben! Uncle Ben! Over and over again. In our leak-induced frenzy, we satanically digested the pilaf. The corn was set free. That was my breaking point. I had had enough. I abandoned the cult and I got off the stuff. I joined a gourmet club, resumed eating meat, and cleaned up my act, my cult life complete. I went back to college and got my degree. The vegetable Satanist life's not for me. I burned all the videos, ultimately. There's no market for veggie pornography. Sort of silly.
Oh, that was great. That was
I like that. I kind of enjoyed that.
That part down the house.
I had a school. I had a guy come up to me after I read that one in Salem.
Yeah.
And he was like, he was either drunk or he was stoned. He says, man, I was a vegetarian once. It's not easy being a vegetarian. Okay. Good luck. Good luck to you now, buddy. Oh, here's one I think is interesting. This is called partiality.
Partiality.
Partially present people, mostly, they are here. That is, they are in attendance, or so it would appear. People whose bodies sit comfortably, whose minds drift everywhere, are partially present people, the ones who aren't all there. The absent look on their faces denies they are filling chairs. Although they occupy places, they give you vacant stares. Partially present people can't be relied upon. Physically, they are accounted for, but the rest of them is gone. Portions of them are missing. As a whole, they are incomplete. Are you only partially present? Are you merely filling a seat?
That reminds me of...
down to two more.
Excellent. That reminds me of someone like... are you familiar with James Thurber?
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of... he wrote poems that were kind of light, but... get up and have a little bite at the end.
Yeah, a little bit of bite to the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bite to the end.
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, there's a way I could have ended it. Am I only partially present? Am I merely filling a seat? Are we only partially present? Are we merely filling a seat? You know? But I went with, are you only partially?
Yeah.
You know, it's a little more in
yeah.
your face.
No, that's good. That's good choice.
Then this is, this one does not rhyme because I have to try. I'm trying to get away from some rhymes occasionally. This is called 5-1-2011. You and I were exiting the Harvard Square cinema as a crowd rushed by. We got Bin Laden, they cried. We got Bin Laden. Filled with patriotic fervor, admiration, and gratitude, I almost congratulated these heroic, possibly drunk university students. But people were also yelling from cars and doorways and apartment windows. We got him! We got Bin Laden! Men and women of all ages shouted, we got Bin Laden! wow, it occurred to me. Apparently, taking down our number one enemy took a lot of brave, diverse Canterbridgians. You suggested a coffee house might have a TV providing further details. Sure enough, it was all over the news. We got Bin Laden. Evidently, CNN had somehow been involved, too. Good for you, Wolf Blitzer. God bless America. I phoned my family. Hey, we got Bin Laden. You told me you were going to the movies, said my sister.
Oh.
Hooray, Wayne LaPierre, and all you folks who care about protecting rights to bring guns to knife fights in the name of self-defense. Perpetuate violence. Support the NRA. Purchase a gun today. Be the first one on your block with an Uzi or a Glock. Or perhaps you would feel better holding a half-price Beretta. Be sure to leave that gun available for your son to bring to his junior high and shoot some kid in the eye. No home should ever lack weapons to launch an attack on the neighbor down the road, plus ammo to reload. Remember, you'll get discounts on machine gun swivel mounts for motorcycles, vans, convertibles, and sedans. Shop at Guns R Us. We don't go through the fuss of checking for proper ID. And your seventh gun is free.
Victor sent us some writing. And I said that we would take a turn to read his writings. So, let's see. He asked me to read B-String. And he asked, and Cassie can read Oriole. And you read, I would try to write you a poem.
Alrighty.
So I'll start. The B-String. Excited by a song coming through my computer, some strummy guitar thing, she asked if she could grab my guitar and play along. I warned her that I hadn't even picked the thing up in over a year, so it might be badly out of tune. She listened to the song and tried to find the key that it was being played in. She ran her pretty fingers up and down the fretboard, searching for notes that were the same as the song's notes. Like the old children's crank toy goes, pop goes the B string. It was a funny moment. The shock that comes with a suddenly broken string. The exasperated look, and then the tumble of apologies. Suddenly she appeared to me as a stone that, when the sunlight pierces it perfectly, shows you something not suspected. What I saw was very pretty. At that moment, I wanted very much to kiss her on the mouth, and take her into my bed, and pull the covers over the both of our heads. I wanted to run out the door with her and join the circus. Maybe I could talk our way into the entry-level position of elephant washer and work my way up to reading children's stories to the ringmaster's kids. She could easily get a job as a cigarette girl or convincing young men to play impossible games for plastic trinkets that look like Shiva on a bicycle or key fobs with the first two lines of Poe's The Raven on them. The passage of a couple of days led me to procuring two new sets of my favorite guitar strings. I thought maybe that broken B string might get me to string my guitar and maybe see if my fingers could even find a chord. It had been a while. I thought much of her in the string of my instrument. I tuned everything the way I do and tried to find the G chord. I fingered it up a fret too high and then brought it back down to where my hand should have fallen. In attempting an A minor, I instead went to D minor. I was suddenly reminded of a Billy Collins poem that I once read to her about a five-piece jazz ensemble of angels playing on the head of a pin. The second set of strings I purchased, I hoped to give to her. Actually, I secretly wished she would let me tune her guitar for her. I wasn't exactly sure how the whole thing would go, because what I really wanted was to simply sit by her side for a moment or two. The stringing of a guitar is a seductive act. The waiting string placed between the lips and the other string being set perfectly, and then being pulled from slack to tight. The long pull of the string and threading of tuning peg. The desire to get it perfect on the very first try. I think I'll take a bath now and try to soak some of my feelings away and let them drain back into where the water comes from. Yeah. Forrester. Okay, you're up with the Oriole.
Oriole. Tuesday. standing at the window wearing my work shirt and only panties underneath, barefoot in the new morning. It was Saturday. My work shirt is a long thing made for tucking into the tops of the dungaree trousers that are provided for me by my work. She didn't wear it immodestly. It was buttoned just short of the top button, and it hung down just near mid-thigh. When I get my shirts from work, I have to order them long and tall. The regular shirts never seem to fit right, and the tall ones are just a little too long. On that hazel-eyed girl, it was perfect. The first time I saw her wear one last year, her curves making that real expression of cloth pop, I was actually kind of startled. I remember thinking, wow. When I wear that shirt and see my own visage in the mirror, it means only one thing to me. I'm brushing my teeth and finishing my toilet so I can look like a presentable truck driver. She stood just a few couple feet out of the kitchen, her hair out and around her shoulders. She had just been complaining to me yesterday that it was too long and difficult to work with, but that the only person that was any good to cut it was tied up for a couple of weeks. Victor, quick, I saw something. The hazel-eyed girl had made some fine spots from the window that she was calling to me from, so I made haste to where she stood. In the tree, do you see it? I peered into the branches trying to spot any color or movement. Where is it? I said. It was at that moment that a striking small golden orange and black bird flew out of the tree and then disappeared out of sight. It's an oriole. She was very excited and ran for the bird book that I keep by the window. It's a whipped-on affair that I purchased at the Goodwill. She stood there in my kitchen, filled with the excitement of that rare bird sighting, all beautiful and barefoot. She read to me the pertinent details about the northern oriole, or what is also called Bullock's oriole. It was on page 426 in Birds of North America. My memory is weird like that sometimes. She had no idea that I spotted two rare birds that morning. The oriole was striking and spectacular in its winging away, but that girl in the kitchen wasn't one that I would chase after with handfuls of black oil, sunflower seeds, greasy suet baskets, and terracotta dishes of water. I would chase for her with words and hope that I could get a sighting one more time.
And so this is the one Victor asked you to read.
I would try to write you a poem. If I could go back to what amounts to a dozen and a half hours ago and collect up all the petty and mean things I said, if I could gather those words up with my large fingers pinching up every last one, I would. Look under the stove, Anik, I would tell myself. Oh, yes, there's a couple words under there. Over in the corner by the bird food, you dope. I would have to find them all. After collecting those words in my cupped hands and being careful that not even one spilled out, I'd take them downstairs to my paper shredder and render them back into harmless letters. If I could do that, I would make piles of the letters, separating the vowels from the consonants. I would divide the periods from the exclamation points. You've never seen such a pile of exclamation points. From those neat little piles and rows, I would try to write you a poem. I'm pretty sure it would be a poor poem. As a man of letters, I'm not. But I would be willing to slam my fingers in the door of my little Geo Metro in order to find the inspiration to communicate my self-injurious anguish. I would walk out into the night intoxicated like all those old Chinese hermit poets and stare at the moon and the water for the inspiration to find a clever way to compare you and that lunar body. I would smell the tiny flowers on the tea rose that I planted for my grandmother when she passed, to remember what beauty is, and to hope for guidance from beyond the grave from that dearly missed old woman. At best, I'm sure that my poem would have all the radiance of one of those refrigerator light bulbs. A tiny 15-watt tungsten soul burning inside of its transparent body. I'm sure that my poem would look like someone trying to recreate Michelangelo's David with pipe cleaners and last week's newspapers. It would probably look like some crusty imposter trying to imitate those Van Gogh sunflower canvases with a hand for a brush and blood, saliva, and tears for paint. I'm pretty sure it would be a poor poem. Still, I would try. I would have to use up all of the letters of the spiteful words in order to redeem them, and the mouth that said them. Oh, my. Think the genie is out of that bottle, though. Wishes have gotten used, and now said genie's got a bigger gig in Vegas. Now he opens up for those assholes wrangling tigers and lions 3 days a week. Not going back in the bottle, no sir, not with 365 days of hot and cold running swimming pools and 24-hour buffets. If I could, like an alchemist, put all of those letters in an alembic, add a pinch of sulfur and a few drops of quicksilver, then apply liberally the ample heat of my shame, maybe I could purify the love I feel for you from the confusion about the recent events. Mercurial indeed. If I could take the ash of that putrefaction and purification to present to you the true feeling that I have for you, minus all my impotence, I would. I would give you my truest intent, a purified gift of honest feelings contained in a tiny decorative gift box. I would offer it up to you and put my head down before your feet. If I could write even just a poor poem expressing how that you are like the marrow in my 206 bones, give or take a genetic quirk or whim of God, I would. If only I could write about the transformation I feel when I lie in bed with you, how my bones turn to steel, and my heart into the best kind of beast, I most certainly would try. I would write about how the beautiful hive that lies behind my eyes runs like a nitromethane-fueled funny car when you are near, how the gnarled digits on the ends of my arms become capable of the expressions of affection instead of hanging there in their familiar skeletal fashion. If I could just go back a dozen and a half hours. Shit, I can't even figure out how to unblock my social media accounts. And I'm pretty sure Vinegar Bob the academic would just call my poor poem prose. Can't win. Holy shit.
Yeah.
He writes.
Yeah. I know. So, I think that he had a romance kind of come to a end not long ago that caused him to write things and then send them to me out of the blue without explaining them. Hey, Ray, here's some stuff to read for fun and profit.
Yeah, well, there's a point there where I was fine. I found myself choking up.
Yeah.
Because there's just some really evocative stuff in this part. Oh, yeah, and I can see how there's a thread through all three of them.
Hello, everybody. I'd like to tell you about one of my favorite poets, Basho. First, listen to what he says about himself. In this mortal frame of mine, which is made of 100 bones and 9 orifices, there's something, and this something is called a windswept spirit, for it is much like a thin drapery that is torn and swept away at the slightest stir of the wind. Let's look at some of Basho's life events. Born in 1644, southeast of Kyoto, he's known to have begun to compose haikai at the age of 12. He continued to publish and study. He took on students. He even had a job working in the waterworks department until the age of 34, when he was recognized as a master. Then he shaved his head and he became a lay monk. He withdrew from public life and moved to a small hut. It was there a student gave him a banana tree called a basho tree, and from this he took his name. Back to what he says. This something in me took to writing poetry years ago, merely to amuse itself at first, but finally, making it its lifelong business. It must be admitted, however, that there were times when it sank into such dejection that it was almost ready to drop its pursuit. or again times, when it was so puffed up with pride that it exulted in vain victories over the others. And what was going on in his life? Well, fire destroyed much of the place he was living called Edo and his little hut. And he began to travel around the world. Well, around his world. He had a travel journal, much like some of us. And then he returned to his home in Edo in 86. Then he took off again on the road. He sold his home. He went north. He wrote another masterpiece called Narrow Road to the Far North. And then he began the concept of sabi, which is solitariness and loneliness that results in lightness and intense concentration. In 91, he returned to Edo. In 93, however, his health began failing. And he introduced a new idea called karumi, which he described as like looking at a shallow river with a sandy bed. And that year, in November of 93, he died. His death poem. Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields. Let's look back again. He said, indeed, ever since it, that spirit he spoke about, began to write poetry, it has never found peace with itself, always wavering between doubts of one kind and another. At one time, it wanted to gain security by entering service of a court. At another, it wished to measure the depth of its ignorance by trying to be a scholar. But it was prevented from either because of its unquenchable love of poetry. The fact is, it knows no other art than the art of writing poetry, and therefore, it hangs on to it more or less blindly. And now, some haiku by Basho. Autumn moonlight. A worm digs silently into a chestnut. A bee staggers out of the peony. A cicada shell, it sang itself utterly away. The beginning of art. A rice planting song in the back country. Midfield, attached to nothing, the skylark singing. Winter solitude, in a world of one color, the sound of wind. Hi everybody, today is a warm, very warm day in July here on Kibbutz Meroz. We've been having some rocket attacks, and this around me is the safe room. There's a window, and it's completely sealed. The walls are about 40 centimeters thick, like about this thick. So we're completely safe here. Don't worry about it. In the background, you hear Acceptance by my son Al Hagi, who right now is on a cruise ship. He's part of the entertainment team, entertaining the guests. And I thought I'd read some haiku for you. So here we go. Birds and I fly the distant fields, then discuss. A lie, a half smile or deceit, forgive or explore. Glad to be alive, dreams leave me exhausted, one bird lends a hand. Neighbor's garden, waterfalls over pebbles. His voice is silent. Symbols of meaning. Clog up my pathway. Time to wake up. This is Archie Shep, Africa. You hear? Okay, let's go. A germ of conscience slowly matures and seeks companions. Look and find. Search conscience and suffer. Or let go and breathe. Collapse of yang. Lost in a sea of mushrooms. Feeble cry for help. Into the future, mind drags cobwebs. Body follows trail. One black cat infiltrates my life, bed and breakfast. Chunk of flesh for me to horsefly, alms to the poor. Towards the light, wherever it leads, curious to see. And we remain curious and we carry on. Hope everyone's fine. Bye for now.
Greetings, Jellicles. I'm here to read you some Roque de Alton poems, poems by the great Salvadoran poet, born 1935, died 1975, perhaps of his affection for communism, which didn't end up going so well because he was murdered by some other communists, one of whom is now in El Salvador's government. Nobody's ever gone on trial for the murder. And it's kind of a sore spot for his two surviving sons. He had three sons originally. One of them died fighting as a guerrilla. Roque was known for having a great sense of humor, being incredibly charming, kind of ugly, but very popular with the ladies. He was condemned to die twice in prison by the government of El Salvador. The first time there was a regime change and the new regime let him out. And the second time he was in prison and he just decided that he would almost pray. He sort of wanted to pray, but he was an atheist. So he said, God, I know you don't exist, but it would be great if you could help me out in some way. And suddenly there was an earthquake and the outer wall of his cell broke open and he was able to walk out and join a passing religious procession that happened to be going by at that moment. Afterwards, he would have these conversations with his friend, the leftist priest, and a couple of other friends, and he would say, no, it wasn't God, it was just crazy luck. And so the priest then just, the inside joke was that the new name for God was crazy luck, suerte loco, suerte loca. Next bit is just a fragment I translated from an essay that somebody wrote about him, about his poetry. And the person who wrote the essay quotes him also as saying, to understand my poetry, you have to understand my life, because he was kind of writing as on the run as an activist. He never had much downtime. He was always one place or another. Mexico, Cuba, Prague, Vienna. He was in Vienna briefly to renew with his sons to renew everybody's passport. This is from a time. This is a piece from the time when he was in Mexico studying Aztec and Maya mythology. And it's called The Restoration of Man by Quetzalcoatl. In fact, it was very difficult to create man. In their enthusiasm, the gods tasted failure many times, and many times they destroyed their work with enraged hands. The men of clay, the men of wood, the men eaten by the jaguar, the ones chased by a wind that turned them into monkeys, the ones burned by a rain of fire, these were very small children. The ones who perished when the sky flooded, when the sky turned to water and crashed down on the men of corn. They hadn't given satisfaction to the former giver of being. They hadn't been truly grateful. Oh, heart of green air, sad were the skies without mirrors, without the mirrors of the eyes of man, O heart of sea petals. Later, Quetzalcoatl went down to Mictlan, the land of the dead. He went to Mictlan Tecutli and Mictlan Cihuatl, the lovers, the master and mistress of the shadows. I come in search of the precious bones, he said, the precious bones you're guarding. I've come to take them. That's why I'm here. Mictlan Tecutli said, what for? What will you do with them, Quetzalcoatl? And he responded, of them will be made the durable men, the men who will be truthful even when they doubt themselves. the ones who won't be dead before being awakened by the rage of the gods at their own failure. They will live on the earth. The gods, I tell you, are worried that someone will live horribly naked on the earth. Mictlantecuhtli's eyes shone. All right, he said, but first blow a note on this conch shell trumpet and walk four times around this beautiful circle. Try it, he added to himself. It's impossible. That conch shell has no holes. It's deaf and dumb. He laughed. But Quetzalcoatl summoned some insect larvae and some bubble bees, both with eyes of dull topaz. And the first drilled some holes, and the second entered the conch shell and made it resound. When he heard the arpeggio, Mictlantecuhtli said, fine, take the bones. But to his people, he said, tell Quetzalcoatl that he has to leave them. Tell the gods that he can't take away our preciousness. Oh, stolen heart, sorrow built a nest like a mortal bird, forever alone, solitude, the pallid void, just a trace of loss in the violated pupil of the eye. Oh, heart of thirst, O son of the ruins, born in nakedness among the rough hands of humiliation. Our warrior father felt the danger in the pores of his skin. He consulted his nahual, his spirit double, and went to fetch the bones. The bones of a man and a woman were together. The nahual picked them up and made a bundle of them. But the gods had dug a sinister hole, a pit, a crater the size of cholera, to hinder the flight of the preciousness of their children. Into it fell Quetzalcoatl among the quails of Mictlan. Into it he collapsed, he dropped dead. The precious bones were scattered, and the quails gnawed on the bones that could not weep, the bones of man and woman. Until Quetzalcoatl came back to life, until Quetzalcoatl turned back to the seed of life. And gathering up the bones, he went like the breeze to Tamuanchan. That's where we came down from. His nahual protesting because the sweat of its fear had not yet dried. Afterwards, the preciousness was finally ground and placed in a clay pot no less precious by Siwakoatl, the swordfish snake, and Kilashti, the seed of greenery. Quetzalcoatl, above the bones, above the dust of them, bled his slender member like a magnificent dying animal, and he made penitence for the germination. Apantecuhtli, the lord of the canal, the river dweller. Huitlolinqui, the lord of the moving shovel, who works the planting stick. Tepanquisqui, who represents the standard bearer. Tlalamanac, who holds up the earth. And Sontimoc, who descends head first. The gods, they all made penitence until the miracle took place, the miracle that had taken so long. And then they said to each other, the humans are born, O gods, the humans we've deserved through our penitence. For them, we, the all-powerful, have suffered infinitely. May there be joy among us. Now we are complete because we have someone to name us, someone to believe in us, someone to pray to us. Joy, joy, O heart, rescued from the night, violent pupil of the greatest lion, drowned in glasses of wealth, now and forever initiated in the victory of the light. O heart of the stone fountain in the lap of wonder, joy, joy. Nudity is the most beautiful fruit. And this next one is called from the history. It's a selection from a longer poem called "The History of a Love," and it's a kind of a dialogue poem between him and his Czech girlfriend. One Thursday, she said, "Socialism? It's not bad. Even the poorest have toasters, TVs, French stockings, good shoes, better pots, clothes that just went out of style in Paris, paid vacations, refrigerators, serious dreams with a small car for next spring, dignified visits to the Office of Foreign Tourism. The only bad thing is that everything is better in West Germany. Haven't you heard about the electric carving knives, the LSD chewing gum, the powdered wine? The condoms with op art designs? As a proletarian poet, you have the right to satirize. But go easy on the lady who so lovingly strips for you, living on great swigs of morality, served in glasses of political economy." This one is called "No, I Wasn't Always This Ugly." This is the penultimate one. I'll read three more. So this is the third from last. No, I wasn't always this ugly. The thing is, a Costa Rican guy named Lisano broke my nose with a brick because I said it was obviously a penalty. He said, no, no, no. I'll never again turn my back on a Costa Rican soccer player. Father Archirandio nearly died of fright because in the end there was more blood than on an Aztec altar. And then Kike Soler hit me in the right eye with the most accurate stone imaginable. We were playing Battle of Okinawa and my retina ruptured. I spent 1 month of absolute immobility at the age of 11. I visited Dr. Quevedo in Guatemala and Dr. Binford, who wore a red toupee. Ever since then, I squint sometimes, and after a movie, I look like a junkie exposed. The other reason was a bottle of rum that Maria Elena's husband threw at me. I really wasn't thinking of doing anything bad, but every husband is a world of his own. And when we recall it, he thought I was an Argentinian diplomat. We must give thanks to God. The other time was in Prague. Four criminals kicked the shit out of me in a dark alley, 2 blocks from the Ministry of Defense, 4 blocks from the police station. It was the eve of the opening of the Party Congress, so someone said it was a protest against the Congress. In the hospital, I met 2 other delegates who had come through their own assaults with multiple fractures. Someone else said the CIA was behind it, paying me back for escaping from jail. Others told me it was an example of racism against Latin Americans, and others of the universal urge to steal. Comrade Sobolev came by to ask if I had touched the ass of an accompanied lady before protesting at the Ministry of the Interior in the name of the Soviet Party. Ultimately, we never learned why I was assaulted. In any case, and to sustain what interests me here, the results were a double fracture of the lower jaw, a severe concussion, 1.5 months in hospital, and 2 months of eating everything in liquid form, even steaks. The last time I was in Cuba, I was clambering down a hillside in the rain with an M52 in my hands, and a bull appeared out of nowhere. My feet got caught in the underbrush, and I began to fall. The bull passed over me, and because he was a lazy bastard, he didn't come back and gore me. But anyway, that wasn't necessary, because as I've been telling you, I fell on top of the gun, which rebounded like a revolution in Africa, and broke in 3 pieces my zygomatic arch, very important for the aesthetic resolution of the cheekbones. This explains at least part of my problem. This one is called Life, Crafts. Forever unavoidable, new life dawns within me. It's a small sun with roots. I'll have to water it a lot and encourage it to play at fighting corruption. Small poor bread of solidarity, flag against the cold, fresh water for the blood, maternal elements that should not stray from the heart. And against melancholy, trust. Against despair, the voice of the people vibrating in the windows of this secret house. To discover, to decipher, to articulate, to set into motion old crafts of the liberators and martyrs, which are now our obligations, and which are out there telling us the steps from breakfast to sleep, from stealth to stealth, from action to action, from life to life. And the last one is called In the Small Hours of the Night. When you hear that I have died, don't say my name. It would hinder death and rest. Your voice is the bell of my 5 senses, the dim lighthouse that my fog would seek. When you learn of my death, say strange syllables. Say flower, bee, tear, bread, storm. Don't let your lips find my 11 letters. I'm tired. I've loved. I've earned the silence. Don't say my name when you learn of my death. From the dark earth I would come through your voice. Don't say my name. Don't say my name. When you learn that I'm dead, don't say my name.
Now, at the beginning of the meeting, I observed that I was going to save the piece I usually typically read at the beginning, the handwritten notebooks. I usually read at the beginning of the meeting to kind of started out, this time not. And the reason why is because I finished my Tangled Gate poems, which I've read to you. I wanted to write new poems. Didn't have a clue. What was going to be my writing without architects and princesses and gates and creatures and so on? So we went to the show last Friday night at the Museum of Fine Arts called Quilts and Colors. This is a show in which you find room after room of these giant, gorgeous quilts that were collected by these two collectors who discovered their mutual love of 18th and 19th century quilts. And they're beautiful. They're beautiful photos Cassie took of them. And imagine these great big up on the wall, because they're big honkers. They're like big quilt blankets, but they're just, you're an artist. I mean, you can see the color and the designs here. Just a beautiful show. And the nice thing about it was that sometimes with exhibitions, the placards that go with the pieces are not very helpful, or they're too presumptive, or they're snotty or something. Each of these had a placard that explained something useful about it.
Oh.
And also there were some placards that explained about colors, like the color wheel,
uh-huh.
and contrast and things like that. Things that an artist like yourself would probably know easily, but the average person wouldn't understand why do some of these colors contrast each other nicely, why do they align with each other nicely, and what was the maker going for.
Uh-huh.
And there were just all sorts of nice explanations like that, so that you had this experience, you had this native experience of color and design, and then you had this educated experience of some of the theories behind what was going on. And they were quick to point out that some of the people making these often didn't have a lot of education. They were doing this based upon either tradition or what they were taught or something that was not from a book,
uh-huh.
just something that their eye told them was interesting in one way or another, and then people call it theory later on when they figure out what it means. So I went there purposefully with the idea that I was going to write something post-Tangled Gate, and thus referring back to the notebook, handwritten notebook at the beginning, a day later, or rather a night later, I took the notes that I had started with the previous night at the museum, and I decided what I would do is I would take the poem I wrote, which is the first one I'm going to read, at the museum. This is what I wrote sitting there amongst those pieces, and then see if I could write variations on it. Just for the heck of it, see what came. So the first one's called At Eventide. Trucks blare smoky noise in the traffic on the bridge over the quiet, muddy river. I sit with my book of melodies on one side. You sit tapping and tooting your pipes on the other. Strange fish glide by, toads seeming to wait, not waiting. In daylight's last hour, the day's clouds and rain leave. Traffic clears up and the trucks leave. Pinkish green and blue umber fill the sky's great window. I read these words across the water to you, breeze carrying, slapping them away. You puff your pipes and meet me in the swirl halfway. Now dark, stars, another world begins. Variation 1. Glaring. Trucks blare, smoky noise on the bridge overhead, traffic fooled between here and there. I study my book of melodies on this shore. You twiddle with your pipes on that one. Strange fish in my book glide by, toads seeming to wait, not waiting. Daylight's last hour, clarity, shine. Trucks go and go and gone. The sky's blues grade down to near forever. I read these words loud across the water. You catch a few, smile, enough to play to, play back to me. Now darkness, better lights, another world releases. Creation 2. Release. The monsters on the bridge above crowd close and breathe heavy, badly. We are hidden to their sad furies below. I hold my green book of melodies, turning thin pages and listening. You play the words my fingers touch across the shore, your ironic perch. Strange fish on the globe forever, toads seeming wait out the worst. Last hours, shine gives way to shine. Something holds, and you play it, and they try to sing. These words touch your fingertips, tangle in your bonnet, land with a sigh. You laugh. You've not begun to play me. Now darkness, more laughing, fingers long enough to hold a heart by the half mile. Variation 3. Evening Tide. They built a bridge out far into the ocean, remains incomplete, like a half-made fist. I hold my green book of melodies in the sand. I am nude and sad in considering that bridge. Strange fish at its far point, their colors uncertain, too dazzling. Last hours, I climb to its walkway, feel it sway, feel it steady, begin to walk. I read from my book, shakily, to your ghost, to your many ghosts, to every ghost alive and remembering. Now darkness, this bridge is holding me better than I am. I keep reading and walk, keep singing and walk. Variation 4. Island of Mind. On this island of mind, seas joining mind to yours, but no bridge, we forgot the bridge. Every page I write is for you, to name you, to touch you, to possess you far. I listen. Are you playing for me as well? Do you remember the bridge? What's Possible by Starlight? I say these words as I imagine your ear, as I imagine your hand, as I imagine your smile, and reply. And finally, Variation 5. Eventide. I just will myself deeper part of world's song. Every page my throat, every page my croon and cry. I will you near me and breathe, relax, and away. I am this book that shifts through your heart, beats and breaths, melodies of waves and daylight bowing. Dream me a fish to nuzzle you, to feed you, to keep you drown, to keep your drown. The darkness is gentle after all, and I hold you, and you hold me, and you say, simple, simple, let be. Yeah. Well, that was fun, unknowing, diving in, a swoop, a splash, the night's gorgeous and soft to the cast.
I like those, man.
You enjoy this?
I like those.
Post-Tangledy, sort of.
Yeah.
You just had to dive in and do something different.
And that show was perfect because it was getting me thinking about colors, contrasting colors, like the color wheel.
Right, complementary colors.
Complementary colors. Cool, I mean,
hot and cool colors.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so that's my, those are my most recent poems.
I like those very much.
I think fairly recent. They were from last Saturday. So.
I just like the way you twist the things. And, I mean, that's just a fun thing to do with one poem, to twist it into six different stories, basically.
Yeah, and I was doing what the jazz guys do with the horns, and I was just improvising.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed in the first poem that there were six stanzas, and each one had a little something to it, so I played with that little something, and I played to the something, and then I played to the something. You just get the word bobbling around in your mind.
This was called Last Call. Where soggy paper napkin people wearing sunglasses inside their eyes stare down pints of numb. Where empty peanut shell people on slippery stools do nightly balancing acts as they pick through kernels of unpopped hope. The black and blue jukebox light limns despondence, its music dissonant amidst constant self-recrimination playing in bowed heads. Hit me again, someone mumbles. Pudgy fingers pours more escape for those who've already been hit enough. Scratch ticket people rubbing their lives away 2-buck drinks at a time. There's privacy here. He takes a stool. What can I get you? Grunts Pudgy Fingers. Give me something to be proud of. It's not a joke.
It's not a joke.
This one.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
Now, that's when you're not, it's not a funny poems, but it is kind of funny in your descriptions. Yes, 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 those descriptions are clever.
They're clever, they're not funny.
Well,
I appreciate, I think the laughter and the smiles, and that's...
They're evocatively satirical.
Admiration, and that's, and I appreciate that, but there's nothing funny about it whatsoever.
Well, they're evocatively satiric.
If you make the same mistake by laughing again at something that I think is serious, you'll punch out. Okay, here's one that's very serious. This one's called Litany to St. Doofus.
It's hopeless, Joe.
St. Doofus, watch over us, answer our prayer, entertain and amuse us in times of despair. St. Doofus, the silly whack job full of grace, protect us from squirt guns and pies in the face. St. Doofus, you bozo, you moron, non-mater, notorious mooner, indulger, and fodder. St. Doofus, you cross-eyed, buck-tooth, roly-poly comedian who taught us all laughter is holy. St. Doofus, you nutcase mistakenly sainted, whose followers giggled so hard that they fainted. St. Doofus, you weirdo, you space shot, you flake, patron of pratfall, slapstick, double-take, idiot sponsor of practical jokes, refuge of asinine, immature folks. St. Doofus, the shelter of us chuckleheads, the mischievous wise guys who short-sheet the beds, and saran wrap the toilets and play stupid pranks, we offer our gut-busting, knee-slapping thanks. St. Doofus, we call on your ludicrous name to help us be corny and goofy and lame, and defend us against the exploding cigar, itching powder, fake dog poop, amen, blah, blah, blah. I read that one at one of my features, and I had a lady write me a letter, and she asked me for a copy that she could send to her mother, who's a minister out in Oregon.
Nice.
I said, I'll be happy to.
There was a line in there I like, though, especially given our meta conversation about your poetry in between your poems.
Yeah.
All laughter is holy.
All laughter is holy. All after his holy. Request of Lord Evan. Now, I've read this, but I don't know if I read... Yes, I'm pretty sure I read this at the BB. Request of Lord Evan. Lord Evan rode his chestnut steed, caparisoned in velvet through the wood, in search of where Milady's castle stood. He urged his charger on to greater speed. Had I two wings to fly, if but I could, Lord Evan, speaking to himself, did say, I would be sorry to be this very day, yea, clasp or kiss her as a suitor should. On faster, do you remember this one?
I think so.
On faster, charger, fleetly run, I pray. Betake me towards Milady's lips, her arms, Milady's love, her sweetly pliant charms, that we might while the starry night away. Through forest field, through fen and fertile farm, upon his faithful, tired charger's back, Lord Evan rode, his blue sky drained, night black. I know not her address, he cried alarmed. Methinks I'm fucking lost, alas, alack. The lady meanwhile blinked, Earl Nottingham. And ere Lord Evan's castle quest was done, his fucking horse died of a heart attack. Lord Evan then did walk, he walking spun in circles walked. My fucking feet doth bleed, perchance a fucking motorbike I need, he wept, a fucking Harley Davidson. I'm lost, no fucking map to fucking read. Fuck me, oh fuck, I've lost a fucking shoe. Fuck all this fucking shit, fuck my horse too. I fucking fucked my fucking self indeed. Lord Evan wandered with no fucking clue regarding where the fucking castle stood. Far from me fucking lady's neighborhood, he swore and cursed her. Fuck you, fucking shrew. I fucking feel like I'm a fucking clown. Why can't you fucking live fucking downtown? As all my other fucking girlfriends do. Of all the fucking luck, go fuck a duck. Fuck, 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 fuck. Fuck, 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 fuck. Fuck, fuck. That's a lot of fun to read in front of an audience.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps you could read for me. Here I make a record of the world I was born into. I let you enter my mind to see. How far back shall we go? First there was polio, then radioactive warfare, then losses and sorrows, and world warfare, which was treated like a fire sale in a sporting goods. Then we scanned the dark skies for spy planes. I sat in my father's lap on the roof of the high school and counted the blue and green lines of his flannel plaid shirt. There were tranquilizers for the mothers and whiskey for the fathers and a loyalty oath going round to be taken with an aperitif at 5 p.m. Somewhere I blanked out, and when I came to, there was wild music, For God so loved the world, he gave it Jefferson Airplane. There was free love in the world of slave trade and McDonald's and political savvy. There was a surplus of bright speech and the sound of bone on bone. There were assassinations and there was the way I rocked back and forth on my knees, knowing mourning and fear, knowing sick grief. Enter to see moonwalks and the fires that astonished me and the man I married who beat me and the lover I took who did not, and how that act of impure infidelity saved my life, how the sweet tongue calmed and cured me. I'll look at its history, a short record of the world I was born into. The thread of that world stitches itself into this world, where planets rise and set, and new warfare makes old history. Now you are entered and you know me. I hear you go, I listen for your return. Our story is inside me, finding its way through walls and revolutions and lovers and acid rain and the truth. Through punishment, the public act of torture and submission. Molecule by molecule, we are one exploding body. Our ceremonies have found a way to escalate a reason. We make love with dedication. We make peace by accident. A summer evening. I tried to meditate, chant, instead raised up my eyes and watched ragged webs of clouds because it was too early for stars. Yes, there was a slight wind, but not one on which to spread sail. The sun monster mocked my efforts to doze. Evenings like that, I have marked the weather by the sun glinting off railroad tracks, by silent greenery around my balcony, by the troubling voicelessness of my wind chimes. Summer suppers are usually late and unimaginative, and I try to make up for them by eating the long day and bread bits as if digestion would grant eternal youth, eternal life. That night, the god of streetlights and the moths that danced to die in those lights brought dark finally. There was acre after acre of darkness, unattached, floating, waiting for me to tell you about it. The looming whatever. The looming whatever that waits for all of us, the undoing, the resistance, the way we push against the sun and the violent forever of October is unsettling. Tiny bird beaks of regret go poking at our hearts and we weep. We weep and tear at our sleeves and try to be reborn in a Jesus who stands hardest full. Remnants, chalky faces at the windows of heaven, bloody knuckles at the door to hell, all this is planned for us. When it's finally evening, we serve denial with chicken merengue and hemlock with a marzipan truffle. We lie down with Whitman and get up with Good Morning America. No matter the words or the music, no matter the seduction of memory, we remain indefinable. We use up the inside minutes of our bodies. I write all this down, first one way, then the other, using words as stick figures to proclaim each death a new death, each rebirth a little less palatable than the last. And finally, your lips were made for songs. We, the dead of a coming day, love your visions. From Pablo Armando Fernandez, From Man to Death. Poets aren't crazy anymore. I have seen this. I am waiting for someone to pick up an old suitcase and notebook, hop a bus, and shout poems into our faces and spaces until we can't breathe. The church, America's stepchild, whispers, it doesn't matter, it'll never matter, and we nod in agreement, fold our hands. Death, take a walk. Go kick the asses of the saints at Fremont, Parkside, Anacapa, Atascadero, and San Francisco General. They don't mind being afraid. I do. America, your fucking slip is showing, you're wearing too much makeup, your bra strap needs a safety pin, the hem is coming out of your skirt. You're nothing now but an androgynous elder in a faded hat. You are not deep nor dirty, even your bloody, impossible war is sterile. What passion for it there was is long gone. The blame goes to God, that professor of all seasons. See, nothing sings in this country. Nothing dances or heals or stays. Ashes of roses is the color of our new temple walls. Now when we fall, we will be like any other leaf from a dead tree.
Martina.
We've been through a lot.
Yep. The Tangle Gate and Liberation. How to begin this? I'm thinking forward and backward both. In this issue of the Seneca, my Tangle Gate poems conclude for now. The original group of poems is 36 in number, referred to here on as TG36. And they appeared in Seneca 83, December 2012. In the 6 issues since, including this one, 60 more poems, titled semi-formally, The Tangle Gate and Elaboration have appeared. These poems are part of Many Musics, a series of poems, series of series, 9 of them in all now, that I've been working on since 2006. And these poems root back to two previous series, 6 by 36 Nocturnes, 2000 to 2004, and New Songs for Cassandra, 2005 to 2006. And you're back further in the poems I've been writing since 1981. These poems are both culmination and accumulation, and so interest me as both where my writing is and how it's arrived here, where it's possibly bound as well. And it's more complex than that, since many musics and previous poems cross-mix with my fictions. Labyrinthine, 2006 to present, Why, 2005 to 2006, and Things Change, 2000 to 2005. And these fictions, these 6 entitled Double Triptych, like the poems, root deeper in older writings. But there's more. Maybe, of course. Since 1985, I've been writing a series called Bags End News, a newspaper about a fantasy land inspired in part by Victorian-era fantasy books like The Wizard of Oz, Winnie the Pooh, Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, and The Wind in the Willows. There are 365 issues of this project so far, and very little of them have been published in the Seneca, although since 2012 I've been reading select issues on my radio show, Within's Within Scenes, from the Psychedelic Revolution. Then there are even more obscurely told tales of the creature common, what might be called experimental pieces that cross-mix with the above but have not much often emerged in the Seneca's pages. And the Tangle Gate poems root much in dreams, too. I've kept a daily dream journal since 2009 and purposely work much dream material into my writing, playing with it, mixing and remixing until something that feels full emerges. The Fountain and TG36 began from dreams, then poems that preceded TG36 by about a year. Culmination, accumulation. I've arrived at this point by working some ideas over and over, playing up sessions through, as well as letting new ideas come, mixing up this and that, seeing what happens. When I wrote On the Making of the Tangled Gate for Notes from New England in Seneca 83, December 2012, I didn't know I'd be writing more, 60 more, and that these would obsess me for 18 months. I've played the Tangle Gate myth through Labyrinthine, through Bags and News, through my more experimental creature common works. The gate was not done with me, nor I it. How I resumed was to pick out some unknown man, not one of the mythos' legendary figures, princess, king, architect, demon, etc., but just a man. I mixed in lines from old poems, dreams, looking for a different way to approach the myth, smaller, closer. Thus emerged slowly the Man of Dreams poems, a love story. Unresolved, a way in, a different way in. A way of indicating to me that there could be more poems if I gave the time and effort to figuring out how. TG36 was told, but here was more yet. To make this all work, what I had to do was presume a before and an after to the original story, and even more to be told during its events. Thus I call these 60 poems, comprising Many Musics Ninth Series, an elaboration. They tell more, some prequel, some sequel, some best called cycle. Think of the elaborate narrative tricks used in the later seasons of Lost. Where it began to take off for me, where I began to get more excited, was with the poems about the demon, the narrative that follows her to the island, the castle, the king. Who is she? Answering that question, that she is a twin of the princess, but they were ripped from each other as children, helped to clarify her motivations in TG36. She has motivations from a now elaborated emotional narrative. Who else then? Well, of course, the brother heroes who traveled with the king to discover the island and the Tangled Gate. Here was practically a whole mythos off the island, leading to the island. How they came together, what their adventures were like, the idea was to arrive them to the island by way of explication. Now we know better, now we know why. So we learned about these individuals and what their quest meant to them, what they lost by it. The two poems before the finale of this group of poems were originally a single poem I divided when it made sense. I divided where it made sense. Wrote the whole of it one magic night in a funky late night diner called the Apa Cafe in East Village, New York City. Now elaborated more was why the island at war with the mainland, who against who. Since I was enjoying this elaborating, why not the sleepers at the end of the world? Why not figure out what they were doing, and to make it even more interesting, why not figure out the beginning of things too? Answers lead to more questions, lead to more answers, and so on.
no real knowing if what comes continues to be good, but I kept pushing, trying to lead from where the story had been to somewhere new or previously unknown. Thus we learned more about the creatures, sourcing somewhat in my experimental unpublished writings, and we discovered that the demon and the architect had known each other at the end of time. I was fascinated. I was tired. I decided to take a chance and follow through on an idea I had failed on before. Begin with TG-36's idea that the princess had chosen to stay in the current world, commit to it, she reset it, and now it was underway. Would she travel its centuries and places, as well as living perpetually in the gate, in the caverns and tunnels beneath, with her beloved creatures? What happens when the princess savior walks among us, another pretty girl in flowery dresses? This was a sequence devoted to see where it would play out, and where it led was to a character named Christina in Labyrinthine and another named Crispa in Bags and News, and two of them becoming counterparts to the Tanglebeast princess, one none many. One project's mystery answered to some degree in another. Even now, the princess's, Christina's, Chrissy's sister has not yet been explored in Bags and News. Soon will. The mythos proceeds by its own modalities. Now it's down to 10 last poems, as each mini-music series is 60 poems, and the ninth series had 50 so far. And I wanted to write these 10 poems for this issue, June 4, 2014, and no later. So in a sense, I was down to writing another, a second conclusion to The Tangled Gate. The distinction I drew was this. TG-36 was about the princess discovering who she is and her power and deciding whether or not to commit to the world she is in. She and the Eternals can stay or move on by her choice. We do not know what this choice was like on previous worlds, only that she has made it over and over the same way, choosing to leave. She chooses to stay this time. What does this mean? It's kind of like a marriage, a binding commitment. She never seems to regret her choice. She's tough and she's loyal. I would choose her as a savior over one who believes you need to engage the worst of men's ways and then succumb to them, thus creating a perpetual racial guilt trip. No, this princess wishes to tend, to heal, to smile, to dance. She is very creaturely, and that's a very good thing. But what of the architect? Here is where these final 10 poems began. Him living in his tower, day and night without end, gift from the princess, him long lonely. His brother, a sort of twin like the princess and the demon are, is Benny Big Dreams, a trickster figure who's haunted Labyrinthine and begs in news for years. Benny here is given a brother who loves him, who he only visits as a mutt. The architect wishes more between them. He also misses the princess and understands better than any why the king's beloved queen seeming abandoned him. It is the final 6 poems where I begin to blow this thing out. The architect enters the Tangled Gate again, looking for the princess, knowing he will have to find the creatures first. He has to humble himself, knowing the limits of his power are not enough. He submits to the beast, to the creatures, and finally to the princess, who, it turns out, has summoned him. In the last 2 poems, I bring the story into the heart of my experiments. I bring the Tangled Gate home and then send it back out. Together, the princess and the demon, the architect and Benny, the creatures around them, will travel waking and dreamland, offering answers to many questions and inviting all along who will join them. Free will is being given the answers and then acting, choosing if to join in healing the world. By music, by dancing, by touch, where there had been none. By kindness to all. Kindness most binds. Circulation relieves distress. The Tangled Gate mythos is thus shared with all, and each chooses what to think about it, if anything at all. If nothing else, the braided thread is left in one's dreams and its invitation, and the words, we two are one, to embrace more, less, or eschew. Looking back, now thinking forward, the last poem is called Leading Off, and by that I mean I'm looking in other directions with new poems. Not much yet by way of big ideas. Almost the opposite of ambition. Going small and trying to make it good. That true and yet the old William Blake fragment. To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. Any artist who seeks not just truths, but psychedelic truths, cannot look big but think small too. Question the micro but wonder the macro. I've thought about spending some hours with old poems, seeing what they mean now. Are there hints of the Tangled Gate longer ago than I now think? That's possible. But does that answer for me what next? I don't think so. I do think that I believe the following line from Labyrinthine will remain deeper true for me. It's all Tangled Gate in a way, all white woods, this world an island. Grain of sand, wildflower, infinity, eternity, a hand, an hour. Now, I'm going to read selectively from Labyrinthine because it's not necessary to read the whole thing. So in part 1, or 51, I'm sorry, it begins a little, there's a little bit more elaborateness to it. He was my mutt Ascarius, and this was true enough. He liked when we drowsed in my armchair when these times came. I didn't sleep as often as he did, but he always waited for me, hopeful. Dumb brute? No. No more truly mute than the trees or the stars above, each to his own kind's tongue and song. He couldn't speak man any more than I could speak dog, starlight or oak. When I'm weary enough but not to sleep, I'll poke the fire up and take my seat with him. He seems longer or shorter with my wish for warmth and nearness. That's fool to say, I say it. Sitting with him, I leave aside my magics and my books. Our chair faces the fire at an angle, and the window shows the great tree I like to see. Windy, wavering. Otherwise, the tower is quiet and still. The fire, the tree, my mutt's breathing. I am the uncalm one in this. The fire snaps, the tree dances, the mutt naps after a time. Only I, among these, am unsure his role. I try to relax, let go into my bones. Breathe, relax, once, twice. And then we learn more about Benny. And about his dream of his dog being his brother. He doesn't know in this narrative that Benny is in the form of his dog. And near the end of the section, when I let go of the wall, I wake again here from the dream. When I let go of the wall, I wake from my dream again here. Armchair, tree, fire, mutt. My shoulder aches, but I don't stand yet. You're dozing in my lap. This is as close as I can get to you. Ascarius is your gift to me. Promise of our bond, even now, as you otherwise dwell forever in the shades and wilds of dreamland. So, his mutt is called Ascarius, and Ascarius is a waking form of Benny. It's like his connection to Benny. But Benny is actually in dreamland. And so then in next section, 52, is the story of is the story of the king, and this is worth reading it a little bit longer. Cease the tide by cursing the moon. Crush the drumheads. Men will pound their stones twice harder. Bind a woman's fire and she will lay dreaming coming stars. Everyone laughs. The king's in good spirits. A fairly calm sea. The island near or soon will be. That we are under way again is both miracle and tragedy. Would we ever have moved on if he hadn't lost his queen? And how? How? Taken? Murdered? Poisoned? There was a changed sense of things one day. Like there never had been a queen, or she long passed in years, like something written in the sand, then crossed out, then the tide coming in. I pay your shaggy head, my brilliant fool. You enjoy being a dog, permission to feel everything in a moment, piss freely. What his crew didn't know was that the king had contacted my brother Benny, traveler in dreams, you, I think, or some kind of you. And Irby drank later that night, kind of a poison, but if survived enough, a deeper entry to dreamland, passage, movement. He bid his brothers goodnight, and they drank on till very late. His move gave them hope. Each had left loved ones back there with sad faces and unanswered questions. You've had no hope till the last meeting with the travelers before setting off. Convinced you'd only find your beloved by dreamways, you promised them a more honored place in your future kingdom. The island would ever welcome travelers for the herb. Now, writing in my bed, poison drunk in my belly, a cloth stuffed in my mouth so none may hear my cries. I have to survive death alone, uncomforted, and the door will open. Strange, there are two. I choose the one to dream this time. You begin to doze. Know this tale. It was you who allowed him his grief, his absolute despair. She saw, finally understood, that yours was to find the island, find the tangled gate. Yours was to save the world. I shake my head, seeing again Mutt where I saw my king. I'd served no man till I knew you. None since, knowing your grief better than you did, why it's so, it carved my heart a groove close by yours. There will be two, you told me that night, when you let us alone, king and his queen together a last time. Give all to the one who comes to you first by the sea. Having done so, the second will come to you, and you may grow old finally. Kissed him last, his wife. You tire of my tower and want to run. I let you chase from my offices outdoors, my day and night without end, my gift from her. I walk more stiffly than I once did. The architect grows old too eventually. But each time you visit me, Benny, each time I am able to form you, mutt at least, when I cannot form a man, I wreck your sacrifice anew. It was you who must keep her till the last, you who selved and broke the king's heart, finally, so he would let go and save the world. Eventually, night again. Armchair, fire, mud, Azarius, brother, I'm not sure. Can I come to you in dreamland? What you don't know as you slumber in my lap, breathing in and out deeply whatever cares you have by man or dog. What you don't know is that I have the dream herb now too, my teacup, what I brewed all night. The architect wishes to know, wills to know. The architect, Benny, will know. Cut, yells the gatekeeper. Cut, asks the architect, Kinley, nods. We have guests on the set. Guests? Kinley is completely bewildered by all of this. The two young men, one scrawny to a scary extent, the other one tubby, but not grossly so. The gatekeeper is kind to them. Nobody knows why. Nobody has ever been allowed onto the remote land set. But these two, he sees what seems to everyone like months of intense filming to host these two as guests. They have questions, smiling, terrified, but here they are, on the island, the architect's tower, his private offices. The gatekeeper smiles, asks. The thin one speaks first. Why would the architect want to go to dreamland? How are he and Benny brothers? I mean, how is Benny a traveler in dreams anyway? Stops, more terrified of his words. The film crew is still hanging around. Kinley seems absent, as does Asterius Benny. The tubby one talks too. What does the architect wish to know? What became of the princess? What do you think? The gatekeeper asks. The two stare at each other. Don't be scared. Tell me. What makes sense to you? They are still silent. You live your lives around this film, my film, yes? They nod. You live in the Nala Theater until I invited you to come with me? Nod. He smiles. It's a kind smile, but it's dangerous. It expects. Then I will allow you an opinion on what happens next. The film blurts, don't you know? I'm curious. Tell me. Give a moment. Think. Then tell me. The two are quiet. The set is completely quiet. The tubby one says, he loves the princess. He always has. So he wants Benny to lead him to her. Or he wants to free Benny from dreamland finally, the other one adds. They look at him with wide eyes. It's like committing a violent crime to speak like this. The gatekeeper smiles kindly. Thank you. Your ideas are inspiring. Now you can stay on the set for the next scene, but over there, those chairs in the corner. They nod, find their seats in the corner, wait to see. And then the next scene plays out with the architect remembering how he studied the princess back when she was his student, and she would sit by the window with his spyglass studying the Tangled Gate and referring to the maps and also remembering what she knew from Dreamland. And that section concludes thusly. I love you still, now, this. I sit in my office now, tonight, and I look over to my telescope, perpetually pointed to the gate, whatever the world. I see you there, now, tonight, breathless, studying, studying, and I am breathless too. Oh, I was then, too, and you are so close. I've come the world and its centuries to be in this room with you. Why can't I stand up? Why can't I approach you? To explain what I know, what I don't, and present myself to your womanly gaze, for your womanly assessment, and perhaps a shy smile, and again a breath, sent of Aster. The gatekeeper looks over to his young friends, nods, smiles. Ready to bow and scrape, they nod and smile in return. But one more to go by request. And so then we move along in the narrative in which we learn about how Benny and the architect arrived. They were two branches from one trunk. Benny was the wild one who would lead them racing up and down hills, and he was always dissatisfied with his lovers, and he was always... He was dreaming more and more, and he would have the architect listen to his visions as he woke up. And then he was gone to dreamland, become dreamland. The architect mourned and let him go and began using dream tools from dreamland to help the world, the waking world. And then he eventually... he helped save the world, and... He forgot about Benny, willingly forgot about him. But then when it finally came around, I'll pick up here. I left for the island the gate and willing forgot you until later, until I was retired here day and night forever, and when we met, it was in waking this time. I had nothing left to ask of you. You still came as mutt, and neither of us pressed man from you. Perhaps where my discontent? Perhaps I want you man, not mutt in my arms? Perhaps begin our travels anew, having saved this world, flaws and all, our turn together again? You sniff, you bark, you lick, pee and roll happily and shit. I want other beauties in these brothers, brother. Scent of aster in my mind, your old laughter too. The gatekeeper looks at his young friends again. They are shocked and hardly nod. Kinley, restless, very restless, hardly held still by Christina. A helpful growl from Maya. Helpful growl. A word to all from Labyrinthine. I will not be held so close for long. These boys know my feral wrath. Nod, boys. They nod. They know.
Feral wrath?
The gatekeeper says to Kinley, to Labyrinthine, a little more, please. We are nearly there, I promise. The tremors raised now do not cease, however. There is near an end to this, and again run wild free. It will happen by willing or will. So, then what happens is that the gatekeeper, excuse me, the architect, decides he has to leave the tower, and he has to go into the gate, and he does, and he scoops water at the fountain, and then he calls out, cries out with all his hope, and he hears the cackle of the imp. And then the cackles lead him on to the cave of the beast, and he is led on, and he appeals very humbly to the beast to let him pass, and he does. And then the beast gives him the blue bag, and the cackles keep him moving at a swift speed. And then he comes to the great cavern where the princess is dancing, and of course, since he's in love with her and hasn't seen her in, I don't know how long. I don't know how long he hasn't seen her, but he hasn't seen her in a long, long time. And I come of a sudden into a too bright central cavern of these caves and tunnels, and for a lingering moment as I stop, crouch, choke my breath, and beat still, I hear the scraping of stones, bare feet upon stones, bare feet dancing, dancing, a live body conjuring songs from patterns and dreams. My heart stops, I fall away. And so then he finds himself back in the tunnel that he came from, and he is in the form of a hummingbird, and he's afraid to approach the princess because she's happy, and he doesn't want to bum her out with his unappreciation for his day and night without end. But then the dancing begins, and he decides to dance, and he flitters high and low, and then he becomes the creature that he turned into to follow the cackles, and then eventually the creatures kind of nudge and divide, and they nose him up to the princess. They like the architect. They sniffs friendly. So when the singing crescendos into its slow close, I feel crowds of creatures dividing in twain before me as I half-intention nudged and nudged by cackles, clicks, clicks, and noises. To now, I arrive, fully formed man, the dance and song finished, I arrive to the shocked, smiling, beautiful face of my long-beloved princess. Oh my. So then we get a little bit of new stuff here. Labyrinthine says, quoting Heraclitus, we are and we are not. Has new friends, they are small, wiggly, kind to Labyrinthine. They generate good feelings between them. Makes work go easier, these kind friends. And then the narrative resumes. The princess and the architect meet each other. We find out she summoned him. And then they are going to go to the grand production in the woods. And they are entertained by the creatures. And they have a very good time, and their hand is melded together because we two are one. And the creatures already know that. And then the production ends. I think he falls asleep or something, but he wakes up and he's panicked, but then they're still together. I wake, cry out, shh, look around. Oh, creature's cavern. They're clustered all around us, still dozing. She smiles down at me. I panic, but feel our hands still warmly one. Relax a moment. Let her arms around me possess me all. So close, release, so close. Yes and no.
recede a little, just a little. There's more, there's else. Not every creature lives safely here, nor most of the world, shaped like men, creatures, trees, everything. It's why I called you, why you brought my blue bag. I nod, I'm ready. And in the final section, Labyrinthine says, again quoting Heraclitus, nothing remains still. Labyrinthine agrees. Having lived in many places, traveled far miles, grown sheet by sheet by sheet, Labyrinthine's friends agree. Things change again and again. Labyrinthine, LX for short, laughs. Things change is a relation. Comfortable friends together, LX nods me to continue. So the princess and the architect look into the blue bag and they find the treasures, who are going to broadcast them where they need to go. And they touch creature to creature, which the princess understands, that touch. The architect seems to be learning because he says, we stopped touching and thus history began. But anyway, they are now close. And they begin to travel in dreams to visit people and show them the story of the Tangled Gate. I'll finish the last little bit here because this is where it shades off into original material. Will you choose to travel with us many dreams like these, learn what we are, architect and princess, and behold the island outside the gate, live with us its story, how we came to be, what we learn to know, what mysteries we cannot wreck, wild cards to our equations, our songs, our histories, our loves. As we sit here now with you in this warm cavern, these friendly creatures all around, some dozing, all partners in the... We invite you to wake when you will, how you will, make of this dream and its light whatever you wish, but return whenever you wish as well. The braided thread we leave, ever weaving through your dreams, yours to grasp or leave lie. And when she at last came and took your other hand, and when he came and took my other, something was now complete, now told of what was and what passes on to be. I did not let go. I am a man, and I both hope and fear. But I willed my heart open wider to all, to every and all. We two are one. We two are one. Together we will architect this world. Together we will architect this beautiful world. Cut! Cries the gatekeeper. And for a lingering moment, all is still. Then Kinley and Christina both stand up, stretch out their muscles from their long sitting. Maya remains seated, though. Benny's already gone, of course. Are you okay? I'm staying. Staying? She nods. I don't think we should be apart, says Christina, getting suddenly upset. Kinley says nothing. Tell her, Christina snaps. Kinley kneels close to Maya, takes her hands. We'll never really be apart. Maya nods. I know. He stands, takes Christina's hand, nods to the gatekeeper whose crew is packing up many cameras. Christina is reluctant still, but Maya smiles up at her, a real, loving, lasting smile, to keep, to remember, eventually to renew. They part the cavern, nuzzled along the way by many creatures. What now? I'm not sure. Deeper in? No. He stops in the tunnel they're in, puts his arms around her, they kiss deeply. Christina is pleased, of course, but unanswered. Remain so as they walk on. Talk suddenly. Princess or demon? Am I the princess or the demon? Oh, the demon for sure. They both laugh loudly, clasp hands tighter, and walk on. Labyrinthine nods at me. A reasonable good conclusion to part nine. Alex's friends are napping nearby. I don't know what next either. Part ten. Yes, but what? It'll happen. It's what you do. I nod, it's what I do. The evening is cool, still sunny. The traffic passes slowly, rush hour, the ironically named time. I sit at a cafe I've not been before, at a sidewalk table, behind a low fence. People pass by, a glittery theater marquee across the street, restaurants. Strangers avoid eye contact in cities. Do not willing touch. Save contact and touch and words for known faces or transacting business. A man across the street sits against a wall, his beggaring cup and sign, shakes the cup, must ignore and pass by. His clothes and boots are well worn, wears sunglasses. It's all Tangled Gate in a way, all white woods. This world an island. When more to say, 'twill come new pages to say it. Thank you.